This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Now, Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, what do you call it, Kramer?
The billiard room.
No.
The name.
The billiard. Not billiard. What? Not the billiards. It was... Come on, Rudy. What? Come on. We call it the place to
be. The place to be. Yes, it's the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
This is the place to be here tonight.
Time to play the game.
Party people in the place to be. Uh-huh. It's about that time.
Place to be Nation. Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
I think they might hear a shock wall.
Actually, it's being John Akiyama is a better version of it.
What do you think, Woodling? You can finally tell Grant Owens you found new music.
I'll tell you what, I am impressed. Mm-hmm.
Sharon Lawson Bram, let's get him a rinky dinky dink.
Yeah.
Let's get a rinky do.
Hey, Nate, man, this is pretty much a highlight of my life right now. I had no idea you were going to be here. I wanted to drive that freaking hoe train. My whole youth. You're the man.
And I thought he meant Nate Milton, the Godfather from Kings of Sport. Do you really think that's the Godfather?
Yeah, I did.
All you have to do is break out that fuck money.
I ate the pie. Watch your mouth, you scraggly Canadian.
That's a bit much. You, who murdered the dog with the sword, and I'm being a little too much.
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself. I was just curious. 5 years! 5 years! We've been doing podcasts. And we have this. This is trash.
To do worse than Josh Richard.
Get on up! Get up! Get on up! Get up! Get on up! Get up! Get on up! You said you got... You said the feeling. You got to get that. You give me fever. And a cold sweat. The way I like it. Is the way it is.
Place to Be Nation! How the heck are you? Just Rosero coming at you live here on this Monday evening, and it is Labor Day. But, Scott, we don't take holidays off. We work them all. But I hope you had a great long weekend, sir.
I did. Good evening, JR. Good evening, Place to Be Nation. Welcome to episode 419 of the Mothership Bit of the Gold Standard. And, yeah, I know I did a very relaxing weekend. I had a picnic on Saturday. Guy in my council, good friend, actually had a pretty boss fire pit. It was pretty... showed a picture to some of you guys. It was like, you know, one of those, it wasn't like one of those cheesy, like, you know, metal dish things. I mean, this guy built bricks out, and it was pretty cool. And then, just relaxed, and since it's the last long weekend for a while, and we were supposed to get a big storm, you know, through here, and whatever the hurricane was called.
Hermione.
Hermine. Didn't touch us. I mean, I don't know about you up in, because you're a little more north than me, or northeast, I guess.
Yes.
But it didn't, I mean, I had sun all day today. And a little wind, but nothing too bad.
Yeah, like most women, it did not touch you. But yeah, it we got a little bit.
Oh, use that joke on tomato. Come on.
We got a little bit of rain. It the last couple hours have been really windy. So if I suddenly drop and we have a half an episode, we'll know why. tomorrow's supposed to be kind of crappy, it seems like. But I don't know. I don't think they have any grasp on which way this thing's heading until like the morning. So we'll see.
Right. But no, we've worked 4th of July. Didn't we do? I think we did 4th of July this year too.
Yeah, and we've done Monday holidays. We don't take those.
Yeah, we're like Vince. We don't take them off. We just do cool, patriotic opens like he does.
Speaking of patriotism, we have a huge American patriot with us here tonight. before we get to the actual show, I wanted to take a moment. We have a new podcast that's going to be premiering soon, and not you and me, someone else. But be premiering on the PWOPTBN network, and I am actually going to be playing a little minor role in this show. So we wanted to talk about it here tonight. And joining us for the first time in quite a while, I don't think he's ever properly been on. He's been on the holiday specials and whatnot, but
he's been characters.
his first official appearance, I think, and that is our good buddy Parv, host of Titans of Wrestling and co-host of Where the Big Boys Play and everything else out there. Mr. Parv, how are you tonight, sir?
I'm very good. What do you mean co-host? Chad is the co-host. I'm the host.
That's true. Is that
okay, Bobby Heenan.
Chad's the luggage that you drag around.
I thought talking about the weather is a British thing. But
no.
Yeah, you guys talking about the weather for about 5 minutes there.
We come out hot on the gate on this show.
Yeah, exactly.
So Parv, we've been talking a lot this weekend because had a little something in the hopper. And of course, I think anyone who follows you on social media or at Pro Wrestling Only knows of your disinterest in the current wrestling product, pretty much as a whole, and that your love for the old school. Of course, that bears out on your other podcasts. But there's a new one you've really been, you know, an idea that's been percolating for quite a while that you've brought into fruition over the past week or so. So I'm going to lay out. I'm going to let you come in. Tell us about kind of where this idea came from and what the show's going to be about.
Yeah, so you know, a lot of my podcasts to date have been old school, like you said. But, you know, Where the Big Boys Play was the WCW podcast. And Titans of Wrestling looks at basically anything before 1984, which for a lot of fans is ancient history. Would you all agree with that? I mean,
yes.
If anything that happened before Hogan,
right.
I mean, before I started Titans, even to me, it felt like prehistory.
I feel like it was ancient in like 1990 when I started watching. It felt ancient, and now 32 years later, it's yes, archives.
Yeah,
because people don't realize that the greatest Intercontinental Champion of all time was indeed the Magnificent Morocco. So.
Oh God,
we're gonna send Scott off to do. We're gonna start like switching podcast partners. I'm just gonna hang out with Parv, and Scott and Stephen Graham can go talk about Don Morocco.
Oh,
I tell you what, Don Morocco, Pedro Morales, for like 2 years. Brutal. I mean, I tell you, people might wonder why Titans Wrestling is less frequent these days. I think Don Morocco may have something to do with that. But anyway, so when, I mean, when I first started those shows, I felt like everybody talked about like the kind of the Hogan years. You know, you guys on this show had done the pay-per-view Vintage Vaults. So, you know, I didn't want to do that again. But I always felt that there was something that I could do really in my wheelhouse, which is, I think, the same as yours, Justin, and maybe the same as you, Scott. I don't know. I'm guessing the Triple H years was your glory years, right, Scott? The 2000 and...
Oh, no. Well, no. I mean, it's...
Scott's
it,
older
it
than
is.
Us combined, Parv, so...
But yeah, I mean, I'll take anything, you know, Toots Mott, or I mean, I am a member of the Goldust Trio, if you ask Justin. So, which is fine with me because I had no problem hanging out and getting free drinks from Wally Carbo and those guys. So that's all right.
Well, I always wanted to do a show. I mean, I've been thinking for the past few months that I want to do a show about, you know, basically the WWF from 1984 till about, I don't know, Austin would be the cutoff point, you know, when Austin becomes Stone Cold. That seems like the start of a different show.
Yeah, I agree with that. Fall of 96 is when a lot of things change.
Right.
Yeah, but, I mean, I kind of didn't want to do the pay-per-views again because, you know, you guys have done it really well, and there's no point in going over that ground again. And I kind of feel like a lot of the big topics have been done to death, but I felt like I wanted to have a show that was going to get into celebrating that world that a lot of us grew up on, a lot of us had fond memories of. The other thing is that, you know, over on the PWO, PTBN feed, it's always been a slightly more hardcore, I guess, feed than the main place to be one. And things got a little bit kind of, we had this thing, the greatest wrestler ever. I don't know if any of you guys, probably you didn't touch it with a barge pole for good reason. And I kind of feel that the things got a bit kind of too, how can I say, a little bit too hardcore. And I wanted to kind of bring it back to, you know, the things that brought us to the dance in the first place. Which for me, you know, as much as I love the old NWA and stuff, wasn't, you know, the Horsemen. It wasn't Flair. It was basically watching Superstars in 1990, you know, that sort of thing. So... really, on this show, which is called Letters from Kayfabe, is the name that we've come up with here, we want to really go in depth on the WWF universe from that time frame. You know, Vince's vision of pro wrestling right there from 84 till about 96. And so, you know, obviously there's going to be some overlap with some other shows. But where you guys may have talked about, you know, WrestleMania 3 or SummerSlam 88 or anything like this, we're talking about, you know, what happened with Buddy Rose's 1990 run? What happened with, I don't know, what were those King of the Ring tournaments like just before the pay-per-views aired?
A lot of lost gems, like stuff that never made it to pay-per-view because there's so much television. Like you said, Pop, we talk so much about the pay-per-views, and that's what a lot of people remember. And especially in the pre-Raw era, you know, when Raw now, it's like there's still stuff hidden in Raws, but there's, you know, they're more memorable. I mean, the real stuff that was like left behind on those superstars, I mean, and challenges.
There's so much hidden stuff. I mean, who was Ian Mooney? These are the sorts of questions that we're going to be answering. You know, what was Rugged Ronnie Garvin doing after his feud with Greg Valentine? You know, who was Colonel Mustafa and what was he doing in 1992?
Right.
Who attended the coronation of King Haku? You know, this sort of thing. I mean, there's so much stuff that happened on Challenge, on, you know, all sorts of things that went on that we don't remember because it didn't ever make it to a WrestleMania or a SummerSlam, you know.
And the way I look at it, it's almost like WWF Magazine come to life in some ways, you know. It's like these weird topics in a, you know, kayfabe light, just looking at what happened within the storyline. Not, you know, we're going to leave the sheets to the guys in between the sheets, right? I mean, this is, you guys are looking more at the, in the world and the scope of what happened on television.
So what
did Ronnie Garvin do in 1990? Not behind the scenes, more what the hell was he doing on TV?
Yeah. Basically, like, what, like, literally, what matches was he having and what was he doing? Or, you know, what happened when Reverend Slick teamed up with Kamala? You know, just stuff that you just don't think about. Like, what were the talk shows before Piper's Pit? Mm-hmm. You know, were there any? So it's all stuff like this. And there, I mean, there are so many different things that we look at. You know, the relationship between Tito Santana and Virgil, you know, like they did have a relationship for quite a long time. So it's kind of, these are the sorts of things we're going to look at. And it's going to be driven. It's called Letters from Kayfabe because it's driven by fan letters. So people can write in asking questions about obscure little things that happen, and we will do our best to answer them. So we encourage you to write in. We did actually get quite a few questions from fans when I put an initial call out a few weeks ago. But if you want to get involved, you can send me a tweet maybe. I'm at Jerry Von K on Twitter. Or you can go to the Facebook page, which is the PWO PTBN Podcast Network. Just search that out on Facebook. Or you can, if you're a member of the Place to Be Facebook group, you can do it in there. Mm-hmm. So
keep saying we, Parv. Who's the we with you?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I should have mentioned that. Yeah, this is me, the egomaniac, right? Already, I didn't. So if I'm the Bobby Heenan, who's the Gorilla Monsoon? It's a chap called Alan. Some of you might know him as Cheap Shot.
Is that like the man called Sting, a chap called Alan?
Yeah, a chap called Alan. he's a British guy who's, you know, very learned fan, loves this era the same as me. And I think a lot of us, you know, we're all in our, I guess, mid early 30s now,
most of us
who grew a lot of us are, who have really fond memories of, like, you know, some of my fellow Titans fans, like Johnny, who's probably older than Scott or Kelly or even Pete, you know, their era was really kind of like 84 85, mm-hmm. whereas some of us are more like kind of 90, right. 91, you know, prime time with you know, Vince in the tracksuit in the studio or the panel, you know. So we're really looking at, like, even though we're covering that earlier era, we've got a excitement for the early 90s where some of the older guys start to get a bit jaded with the product, you know.
Right.
So, yes, it's Alan, and you can find him. In fact, you'll probably get a quicker answer from him because he's one of those guys who's on the Twitter quite a lot. His name is... at Alan_CheapShot. So you can send your questions to him as well. And yeah, he's got a lot of good YouTube channels as well. Mm-hmm. So ask him about them.
Now this is going to be a weekly show, right?
Yeah, so it's going to be weekly. It's going to go out on every Thursday. And we're going to stick to that schedule as much as we can. And as Justin alluded to, Justin is our correspondent in the event center there. Mm-hmm. So he's going to have he's going to come up with all sorts of little hidden tidbits of information in the middle of each show. So
yeah, that's it. It's a little something to bring the brands together. And I'm really excited. When I saw you kind of tweeting about the idea, I got my antennas up because I'm like, you know what? This is my period, and Scott and I are so far removed from it. That's like, it'd be kind of nice. And actually, we're kind of touching it again. We just reviewed all the Saturday's main events in written form, and now we're on the Raws. But it's cool to be able to kind of look back and just generate ideas. So yeah, you'll hear from me just for a couple of minutes every episode. Nothing too much. You and Alan will be the stars, but I'm there as your Sean Mooney, sitting in, or Ian, whoever you want it to be, sitting in the event center. Just give you a quick update, what's to come, and kind of what's on my mind that week. So every Thursday, PlaySmation.com and on the PWO PTBN feed, we'll be socializing that out as always. So we're really looking forward to it. I think it's going to be great. I think the ideas we've come up with have been really good. So if you're a hardcore fan of that era, this is a must for you. If you're interested in learning more about the era, check it out as well. But I think it'll be a really cool show. I think you guys have good chemistry, and I'm really looking forward to it.
And we recorded the first one, the first couple earlier on, and even I have learned stuff. I learned stuff I'd never have heard of or knew before just from talking to Alan. So yeah, definitely if you love that era, if you're a fan of Place to Be Vintage Vaults, then it's definitely a show for you. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Hey, no problem. Scott, why don't we go ahead and take a break? We have Timothy Buckner of This Week of Wrestling in Lucha Undead. He'll be joining us momentarily to talk December to Dismember. So let's just get the break out of the way now, and then we can take it home.
Well, just give me the sign, and I will be gone. Yeah. That's how much I feel for you, baby.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you're subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Just head to iTunes today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be podcast feed, the PWO PTBN feed, PTBN Pop, and of course the Kevin Kelly Show feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Some really great stuff. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. Thanks for being a fan of professional wrestling. More importantly, thanks for being a fan and supporter of the Place to Be Nation.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here. In addition to the archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, in our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. Relive Wrestling's Past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. All of this in addition to Scott Keith's Podcast of Doom, which includes discussions on questions from listeners, as well as current day and old school wrestling. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the Reaction Shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
All right, Nation, we're back from break. Hope everyone enjoyed our little visit from Parv. Be sure to check out that new show, Letters from Kayfabe, coming. I don't know if it's starting this week or next week, but it will be each and every Thursday, like he mentioned. So be sure to check that out. Check out everything else at PlayStation.com. Steve Riddle had up his Vintage Vault previewing. Of course, he's covering all the CM Punk matches, so he did the main event that we'll be talking about later tonight. Between the Sheets with Chris and Bix, looking at August 31st to September 6th, 1988, joined by Jordan Breen. Scott, we finally finished season 7 of the Seinfeld rewatch. We got 2 seasons to go. We're almost there.
Wow.
Susan is dead, so everyone's rejoicing. So, a lot of fun.
Is she the one who's from the stamp glue?
Yes.
Okay.
New podcast as well has debuted. In addition to the one you heard about earlier, we have our buddy Andy Aileen and Tim Capel with Survey Says, a WCW retrospective. And it's kind of funny the way it worked out, because I look at it as very similar to what Parv's doing, him and Alan, because this will be looking at WCW, but not pay-per-views, not TV. It's just going to take topics and talk about topics that you may have forgotten or they want to just discuss. So if you like WCW and everything that was about it, these guys love it, and they're going to be talking about it in depth. It's a great show. They put a lot of work into it, a lot of prep work, so you know it's going to be good out of the gate. Check that out. The NBA team also returned. Andrew and Adam, building their own expansion teams, kind of welcoming themselves back into the podcast world. And, of course, they'll be firing up more and more as we get closer to the NBA season, which, believe it or not, is not that far away. NFL kicks off this week. So we'll be here before you know it. Glenn Butler also hit his podcast, episode 26, the Star Trek Mailbag. So lots going on, a new Hard Traveling Fanboys podcast, and, of course, Clotheslines and Headlines last week, which I thought was arguably one of our best shows. And Timothy is our guest here tonight, Timothy Buckner. I should give you official welcome in a moment, but he was on with us. He previewed Battle of Los Angeles. We talked about Ring of Honor, all the fallout from Death Before Dishonor, him and Brad. Glenn Butler and Timothy looked at Lucha Underground. We're previewing Season 3. That was a spoiler-free preview, so if you want to go back and check that out, give our thoughts on Ultima Lucha Dose. And also Todd Weber joined us to talk about WWE. We talked about all the ripple effects from Finn Balor's injury, the reaction to Kevin Owens' Universal title win, Miz's big promo, and kind of took the temperature of where we are as wrestling fans right now. So I thought it was one of our best episodes to date. I think you all agree, so check that out. And Scott, all of our written stuff is up and running as well. Our network adventure, we looked at a TNT. We're closing in on 1985. And, of course, our Vintage Vault Refresh series, Monday Night Raw, we're into July of 93. So lots going on, PlayStation.com. Follow us on iTunes and all of the social media platforms. So, with that said, Scott.
Hey, what is going on here?
There you go.
There you go. School starts. So you can be in here now without acting weird.
Yes.
We are, JR, coming to the end of the calendar year of 2006. We are, of course, in the middle of the creative year, 2006/2007. If there was ever a creative black hole, this show was it. Tonight, inside the Vintage Vault, we bring you ECW December to Dismember.
And the man who's never devoid of anything creative is our guest tonight. I mentioned him earlier a couple times. He is one of the co-hosts of the Lucha Undead podcast. He is one of the co-hosts of This Week in Wrestling, and that is our good friend from the West Coast. He's just getting over his long weekend of attending all of the Battle of Los Angeles, PWG's big yearly show, and that is Mr. Timothy Buckner. Sir, how are you?
Yeah, I feel like one of these, you know, whirlwind traveling guys, like a Dylan Hales or the Papa Hales or the Frey Movement, where I'm making all the towns because I was talking to you about, you know, being at ROH, and then I'm going to be at PWG the next week. But this is like the high point for me, and then the rest of the year I'll lay dormant. But super excited to talk about a show that maybe doesn't hit the same heights as the shows that I just saw this weekend.
Well, it may definitely wouldn't in different ways.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
I guess they're depths rather than heights. I don't know. But super excited to talk about it. Big fan of this podcast in general, and a big fan of that Survey Says show. I got a chance to listen to that over the weekend. I recommend it to everybody.
Fantastic. Glad you got to check it out already. Those guys are so excited. They sent us like a PowerPoint deck with a project plan of that show. And it was like, guys, we love you. You can have any show you want on there, you know, but they were so excited. So it's a great listen. Be sure to check it out. And I'm glad you did already, Timothy. And this is a show you reserved like months ago that you wanted to be part of. So hopefully you're ready to go here. And of course, you can hear me and Timothy back when I did my big shoot interview on Lucha Undead. So check that out if you haven't. I always get taunted that Chad Campbell's numbers were higher than mine, but I think he just listens on all different kind of, you know, sources, his phone, his iTunes, his website, and pumps the numbers up.
Plus, he's probably got more kids. He's making them listen to it, and the wife, he's probably making her listen to it too. So
yeah, he's got the Hales family in his account. Back pocket too. So it's a whole thing.
That's true.
It's a whole thing. So there you go. I know Scott listened to mine anyway. I hope. No. Okay.
What? No. I'm so behind on podcast listening. Okay. But
well, you should listen. You're featured quite a bit.
I know. And I greatly appreciate that. It's a great show. In fact, I'm going to have one of your clotheslines and headlines guys on later this week. Mm-hmm. Because he lives near where Backlash is going to be on Sunday. I thought he was going, but he is not. But the Godfather, Nate Milton, should be on main event this week. But anyway, let us get out of the present and into the unfortunate and very sad past. December 3rd, 2006, live from the James Brown Arena. Ow, she's a sex machine in Augusta, Georgia.
I guess we got our music now, we know, for the in and out here.
Yes. Living in America. That's yes. What we should play. Yeah, I never thought we'd even be in the town of Augusta, much less this building ever.
Yeah.
Of course, Augusta is known for the Masters golf tournament, but
and all the racism that goes along with it.
And it goes well, and sexism, but yes. I think they allow blacks and women there now. So, okay. It took like, you know, 90 years, but all right. JR, give us a little history, if there is any, of this of this fine venue that we'll
I
be
bet
in.
James Brown got drunk and opened an arena. That's my guess. So, let's see, this opened 1974 under the name Exhibition Hall. And then as an arena, or I'm sorry, it was an exhibition hall. And then January 24th, 1980, opened as an actual arena. The Augusta Lynx of the ECHL played there for 10 years. The Augusta Stallions of the AF2. The Augusta
yes.
Colts of the AIFA. And the Augusta Riverhawks of the SPHL. So there you go. The big incident that I have note is the ice system malfunctioning, causing all the arena ice to melt in 2013. Yes. Only an 8,000-seat arena, 9,167 looks like is the true capacity for certain events. So there you go.
And they yeah. were safely within those boundaries for this show that we're watching
yes.
tonight.
Yes, yes, they were. Your attendance, right around 4,000. Hmm. So 4,800
right,
to
right.
be exact.
So just under 5,000, yeah.
Yeah, 4,800. I don't even want to know. I don't have a buy rate in front of me. I can't fathom it being
that. Let me see if Sutton put it in. 90,000 buys. So.
Okay. And so what's that, 0.9?
No, yeah, it's actually not too bad. Oh, 0.0. Yeah, 0.09. Yes.
0.09.
So, it is
so
bad.
No, it sucked.
Yes, it is bad.
Yes. It was fucking terrible. And well, your announcers.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, and your announcers, the voices of whatever, the purple brand, the orange brand, whatever we made it. Joey Styles. And Taz, and I have a lot to say about those two as this show progresses.
And it's an interesting time, too, because like I remember being excited, and it was really cool that ECW was getting another show. The name was great because it was a throwback, and we'll talk about that in a minute. It was actually mm-hmm. a show that had happened. But this was during a real glut of pay-per-views. Like, we talked about Survivor Series a couple weeks ago. This was 2 weeks after Survivor Series, and then 2 weeks after this was Armageddon. So it was, like, unprecedented at this time to have that many pay-per-views jammed into this tight stretch. And it had to have affected the buy rate for all three. And what didn't help was the card of, you know, what minimally of it was it even announced for the show and the state of the ECW brand that we'll talk about. Timothy, at this point, where were you as a wrestling fan? Is this something you went back and caught up on? Do you remember hearing about it, being excited for it? Where were you at?
I was excited for ECW in that I was a huge ECW fan when I was even younger and, like, probably too young to be watching it, if I'm perfectly honest. And it felt like a big deal that ECW was coming back. And I remember the One Night Stand pay-per-view, which was, you know, 2 years prior to this, just about being a big deal, or maybe like a year and a half. And I was super excited about that existing in general, just to be like, oh, cool, you know, ECW's back. But then when I stop and think about it now, it almost seems insanely too soon. I guess I was just younger and the time just felt longer. But if you think about it, ECW had only been out of business for maybe like 4 or 5 years by the time the first One Night Stand happened.
Right.
But my wrestling fandom was more on the indies. So I was focusing on ROH, Chikara, PWG even at that point. And if WWE did something that interested me, I would pay attention to it. But for the most part, I wasn't super into it. So the One Night Stand was, oh, okay, cool. I'll definitely check this out. I was into it. Did the second one. I'm like, awesome. And then I hear, oh, they're bringing it back as a TV show. And it was, I just thought, oh, it's going to be more of the same. But I never even watched the TV show, like, to be perfectly honest, at the time. I've gone back and watched most of the, you know, the ECW rebrand and just kind of seen what happened there. But at the time, I was like, even me as a casual, I guess, WWE fan who was a hardcore ECW fan, the rebrand or the revival thing of ECW just lost all of its novelty for me after two shows. So, yeah, this was, I felt like it was kind of destined to fail from the start.
And it was kind of a hybrid for a while up until around this point. We'll talk about why in a moment. But, Scott, I felt like they were really sputtering away from the original intent. Like, the original intent seemed to be, we're recreating ECW. And then by this point, it seemed to be, all right, we're not really caring too much about ECW anymore. We want this to be kind of a fertilizing ground for younger stars or guys that, you know, I guess in the spirit of the old ECW was more the point. Now we're going to start grooming younger stars or sending our guys down from the bigger brands that maybe need some work or retooling. That's what it felt like to me around this period.
Well, just look at the main event and you could see that pretty clearly. And when I get into my steps of the main event later, it pretty much is the proof of that. This was not the pay-per-view that I think Paul Heyman envisioned when ECW launched in whatever it was, May or June. June, I guess. I don't think he had any thought that this would be the card. So having said that, I think that's what led to a lot of the drama going into that evening backstage and what would the repercussions or the fallout would be later on that night and the next day. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty evident just looking at this card. And like I said, just looking at the six guys in the main event that that this was no longer Paul Heyman's baby anymore, that it was pretty much Vince took the toy away from him and is playing with it himself.
And I think we should, we're going to cover that to start because I think it shades the way the show goes. So first let's go to some of the Sutton report here. This is the second December to dismember. First one was back on December 9th, 1995. Main event of that card saw a double Jeopardy cage match with the Public Enemy, the Pitbulls, Tommy and Tommy Dreamer defeating the Eliminators, Heavenly Bodies, Raven and Stevie Richards. Also on the card, Sandman captured the ECW title, winning a three-way dance over Mikey Whipwreck and Steve Austin. Tagline for this show, you better watch out. You better not cry. Do you know the theme song? It's the most obvious, of course, for every ECW show.
Duh, Bodies by Drowning Pool.
Big Show, in 152 days into his reign as champion here, 25 ECW episodes, had debuted. Couple of vintage news bits. December 1st, it was a behind-the-scenes battle regarding Garof Van Dam traveling to Camp Victory for the tribute to the troops. The company wanted him to make an appearance, but due to safety concerns, the company could not force him to go. This is the second time Van Dam basically said, go fuck yourselves. On December 2nd, Van Dam's contract with the company was set to expire in 6 months. Several sources said he's frustrated with the ECW, and some people wondering if Sabu is trying to get released due to his recent behavior as well, getting a lot of heat for sleeping backstage and showing unprofessional behavior. So, There you go. So let's talk quickly about what was going on behind the scenes. So this pay-per-view marks officially the end of the original incarnation of this reborn ECW. The day after the show, WWE announced that Vince McMahon had officially sent home ECW head honcho Paul Heyman. The website claimed that Vince had decided slumping TV ratings and a disgruntled talent roster as reasons to exile Heyman. Heyman and McMahon get into a big argument on the plane the next day. Following a meeting, Heyman is removed as head of the ECW creative team, escorted from the arena, and sent packing. It was clear to many that McMahon was attempting to put the blame on Heyman for the panned pay-per-view and ratings. Heyman saw the writing on the wall, said, "Fuck this, I'm out." Turned down Stephanie McMahon's offer to return to his former post as the head of developmental. It was revealed that Heyman was against Bobby Lashley being involved in the main event, at least to the level that he is, and we'll talk about that later. McMahon believed the fans should be sent home happy to see a new champion at the end of the show. Years later, Heyman revealed how he would have booked the Elimination Chamber, saying that CM Punk would have eliminated Big Show via submission, a technique he often used in multi-man matches, and then going from there would crown his new champion. McMahon was not pleased with the idea. Big Show disagreed with Vince, and he was into the way Heyman was booking things. Looking forward to helping establish a new rising star, Heyman claimed that he kept telling McMahon on the night of the show, "People are going to throw this back in our face." He was proved to be right. The negative reviews of the show would lead to the end of the original ECW. From here on out, it become radically different. And then following his departure, Heyman created his own website, forging a working relationship with the UK Sun newspaper and working as an advisor for Brock Lesnar. And, of course, we all know when he returned in 2012 as to what he's up to now.
Right.
Here's some added notes from Sutton. So, PW Torch reported that Vince himself rewrote much of this pay-per-view on this day. Several of the ECW roster members knew what Heyman had originally booked. The ideas were on the table, like we mentioned. However, Vince rewrote the story to make sure it went the way he wanted. Realized how bad it was, he called the meeting with Heyman and Stephanie and blamed Heyman for it. Heyman said, "F you, I'm out." Veteran reporter Bill After shared a story from that pay-per-view from a meeting with Paul. "After exchanging pleasantries, I started a dialogue with my negative feelings towards the ECW product," said After. "But Heyman didn't let me get too far, cutting my words off quickly and saying, 'Bill, don't go further. I know where you're going with this. Everyone says the same thing to me, how ECW is being ruined. No one cares about ECW like I do and some of the boys who are busting the nuts to keep it going, but it's too frustrating to talk about, so let's not." So, Scott, what did you think of all this with what's going on?
It makes perfect sense. It makes sense that this is what happened. I think the writing was on the wall, probably throughout the summer when the Big Show was crowned ECW champion to begin with. They were trying to use guys like Sabu. They were trying to use RVD, although RVD kind of did it to himself. So anything at this point is kind of on his shoulders. Because with what happened to him back in June, I wonder, he probably would have lost the WWE title anyway. They needed to siphon that off to Edge and Cena. But I wonder how long he would have stayed ECW champion had he not gotten in trouble. Having said that, I think you could just tell as the roster was building, other than Punk and maybe one other guy, the roster was mostly full of Vince-type guys. You go back to 1995 ECW, you ain't going to see Bobby Lashley anywhere. Or Test, or any of those other bloated goofs. You're going to see guys like Sabu and, I mean, Elijah Burke, who we'll talk about in a little bit. So it was pretty evident that Vince's handprint was all over this to begin with. You knew it was eventually going to come to a head. And I got to be honest with you, I was kind of surprised that they actually got their own pay-per-view. I wasn't upset. I was actually thrilled. I was just surprised. I never thought that Vince would give either Paul or...
I think it was on the books as soon as they said the brand was coming back, that they were going to have two a year. The plan was one night stand and then another one at the end of the year, I think.
Oh, okay. See, I don't really remember that. All right. That makes sense. I just didn't know that. But then you would have thought this would have been booked, been more organized and booked better, but we'll talk about that as we get closer. Tim, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard different reports about ideas being blamed on one person or the other, but it's pretty easy to see if you're familiar with Paul Heyman, which I am as a longtime fan of his work, what stuff did stand out, what stuff would have been for sure. But there is also the Big Show was leaving, and one report that I read just recently, going back kind of getting familiar with the time, was that it was Heyman's idea to get Lashley, and Lashley was going to then become the new Big Show as he was going to turn heel the next night and partner up with Heyman and essentially just switch it right over to the Big Show to continue the kind of dominant heel figure on top. And, you know, they kind of neutered that whole thing. And then not having Heyman there to cut promos for Lashley and help him develop a more solid character really just kind of exposed how green he was at the time and how much he wasn't ready to carry a brand for the future. And I think the blame just goes all over the place, but it's funny to hear the stories of Sabu's, you know, caught sleeping in the back when he shouldn't be. And then it kind of almost seems like it's a rib the way it plays into the angle that they shoot later with him. But I mean, overall thoughts, I guess we'll just kind of get into stuff as we review the show, but it clearly was a watered down version of ECW and nothing like the original at this point.
Agreed.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yep. All right. So why don't we talk about, the Heat match. Stevie Richards defeated Rene Dupree. And it's also noted here, Stevie and Tommy Dreamer actually requested their releases, were refused by Vince and John Laurinaitis, the head of talent. So they tried to walk with Heyman. They said no, and they're here to stay for a little bit longer anyway. So there you go. All right, Scott, why don't we get started?
All right. Here we go. Our opener is the one that's probably most remembered as the match on this show, because we had a couple of reunitings, if you will. One sort of made sense. The other made no sense, in my opinion. But how do we get here, JR?
All right. Heading into the show, the Hardy Boys issued an open challenge to any team on 11/27. Joey Mercury made a surprise return in the now reunited M&M. And I'll say they were accepting the Hardy challenge. The next night on Sci-Fi, M&M jumped the Hardys and left them laid out. Following May's Judgment Day, Joey Mercury had been suspended 30 days for violating the wellness policy. Due to that failed test, M&M were split up and Johnny Nitro Molina switched to Raw as a singles act. Mercury would be placed in rehab, paid for by WWE, and upon completion, returned to OVW to get back into ring shape, made his surprise return on 11/27. So here we go. The Nitro push on hold for now. M&M's back. So is the Hardys. And we're going to talk about that in a minute because I want you guys' take on that. Both teams pretty much imported here to help flesh out the card. Molina looking pretty good. We get a big pop for the Hardys. Matt and Mercury start things off with trading holds on the mat. Hardy start to tag in and out and work the arm of Mercury and then double team M&M. Nitro gets some offense but misses a splash. Matt tags in and hits a splash mountain bomb for two. Molina trips up Matt, leading to Mercury cutting him down at ringside. M&M takes over, works a good tag, and double team-based offense. Focusing on the midsection, Molina gets involved too, doing a sensual head scissors as Matt was hanging off the edge of the ring. Matt wipes out both as M&M clobbers Jeff to block the tag. M&M hits a poetry in motion, which I thought was a nice touch. Matt escapes and makes a tag, and Jeff comes in and takes it to both guys, grabs a near fall, but then Matt comes back and hits a slingshot cross body to Mercury on the floor. Nitro follows that by flying out into both guys, and then Jeff flew into all three with a dive off the top. Matt hits Nitro with a twist of fate, but he avoids a swanton. We get a nice tease there. Nitro comes back in with a springboard dropkick to Jeff and goes back to work, and they start working the back of Jeff. M&M again keeps tagging in and out, punishing the back with submissions and strikes. Matt gets knocked down to block a tag as a second Heat segment rolls on. Jeff breaks free, makes a hot tag. Matt fights off both of M&M, hits a side effect on both, and gets a near fall. And then gets another two count with a leg drop off the second rope. M&M battles back, and Nitro hits a top rope hurricanrana on Jeff. Things break down. All four of the guys start fighting. That leads to stereo superplexes by the Hardys, which I loved. Molina distracts the referee but gets clobbered off the apron, leading to a Jeff roll-up for two. M&M hits a snapshot on Jeff, but Matt makes a save. M&M tries for a super snapshot off the top. Matt again makes a save and hits a double twist of fate on both, putting them on top of each other. And then Jeff hits a swanton onto both guys stacked up to get the win. I thought it was a pretty damn good opener. No gimmicks or weapons were needed, just straight tag wrestling. I thought it was a great way to get the show going. I thought it was a cool idea to reunite both teams, and it could lead to stuff like this for a cool moment. So, guys, I want your take not only on the match, but also on bringing these teams back together. Do you think it was necessary? Do you think it was needed? And do you feel that, at least on the Hardy side, it felt like a super team? Either one.
Go ahead, Tim.
Okay. It felt like probably a bigger deal when it came to the Hardys. I don't know if the M&M, if it really felt as big of a deal that they're reunited, but it felt like a team that you could believe in there with the Hardys could beat them, guys who felt like a good tag team. Off of Nitro, having at this point what now feels like two failed, you know, singles pushes, even though the second one was more cut short just because his tag partner was returning. But he did look like a guy who they kind of went, well, every time he's tried to work singles, it just doesn't work. So it's like, oh, you throw him back in the tag team, and he's a guy who is a contender. And it was probably necessary in the regards that they fit the role that was, I mean, in some ways, this pay-per-view was very much in the same archetype as an old ECW original pay-per-view, that you didn't know a lot of the card, and you start out with a hot tag team match to just kind of set up that this is going on, that this the show's happening, get everybody into it, and then from there kind of lead into more stuff. The way it used to tend to work on old ECW shows, though, was more like that they would have the match, it'd be like a singles match that morphs into a tag that then morphs into a three-way dance or something, or a trios match or something along those lines. And then this instead, what they did to eat up all that time was just have a match that felt like it went a little too long. I think sometimes in my memory, I conflate this match with the Backlash match where Jeff gets his face busted open. Because I think they were, Eminem was returning that night, or one of the two teams was returning that night as well. And it makes me always think that this match is better than it is. I think it goes a little bit too long. I definitely do think it was necessary, and it did feel like a big deal that the Hardys are reuniting. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think it's overused, and I think that they should have done something else rather than give this match so long. And from what reports or whatever there is, it's like the reason why it went so long is because they really were just trying to fill out the card with as much as they could,
yep.
Trying to put everything together. And they said essentially go out there and eat as much time as you can. And Matt Hardy's a great guy for, you know, putting matches together that make sense. But uh-huh. at a point here, it really does feel like it's excruciatingly long.
Well, the double heat segment bears that out. I mean, it's a trope they use occasionally, but they broke it out here. And both heat segments are pretty long. Like, it wasn't just double heat. It was like Matt had a full heat segment and then Jeff got trapped in a full heat segment. And I agree with you. I think it's... you could definitely tell they're out there just filling time that they imported these guys due to the lack of depth. What are your thoughts, Scott?
Well, there's no doubt that the roster for a full-blown ECW pay-per-view was probably a little thin, so I think it was necessary to do that, to put them on in the beginning. It did kind of have that old ECW formula, but some logic things here kind of threw me off. Step one, if the Mercury thing was true, and that the only reason that Eminem broke up was at the time was because Mercury got pinched and had to go off for a while, and Nitro. Then why they do the whole beat the shit out of him? And if it was slated to be temporary,
I don't think it was. I think it was slated to be a way to launch Nitro, and then when he didn't really get over, they just said, okay, Mercury's coming back, let's get them back together. If Nitro took off and like became a star, there's zero chance they're back together. So I think it was just to break them up, and we can always reunite them if we have to.
All right, I don't know. That kind of bugged me that like they absolutely pummel the crap out of him, and then only 6 months later, all right, we're back together again. And that annoyed me for some reason. Step two, we're talking about these announcers. Taz, I mean, I'm listening to, going back to some of our older vaults, and I'm into listening to late 2002, and Cole and Taz were fantastic. I don't know what the hell his problem was tonight. I don't know if he was drunk, or I don't know what the deal was, but the two, him and Joey, were like a mess the whole night. And at one point, when you're talking about the Melina head scissors, he says something like, oh, who wouldn't want to have their head caught between Melina's legs? And then you hear silence. You hear, all right, sorry. So I don't know if like Vince yelled at him in his ear or whatever. I don't know what that was. And at first I'm like, did he really just say that? What is going on here? It's like, oh, my God. I was not as big a fan of this match. I mean, I'm looking at our old write-up, and I gave it 4 stars. I don't know if I would give it 4 stars. Mm. I thought at times it was slightly disorganized, which is not like these guys, either of these teams, when they wrestled earlier or when they wrestle later on. I wasn't a big fan of the match. I would give it maybe 2.5, maybe 3. But I thought that the last, you know,
I mean,
5 minutes.
When you compare it to the rest of the show, it's like 6 stars. But
oh yeah, if you're the rest of the show, it's like fucking Savage Steamboat, or Rockers Orients or something. But it just wasn't as good. They could do better. Let's put it that way, and we would see better from them later on down the line.
Do you agree? Does it feel like the Hardys to you? I think we talked about Survivor Series. They're more singles guys coming together as a team versus like a team. In a good way, like in a positive way. Like it feels like these guys are bigger than it, so it almost feels like main events are coming together now.
You mean the Hardys? Yeah. They're not the Hardy Boys anymore.
Right.
They're not a team anymore. They've done it. They were. I mean, Jeff was gone for so long. Obviously, wrestling fans watch other promotions, so they knew he was a main eventer in TNA, as bad as he was. So, no, this isn't the Hardys of 2000 and 2001 anymore. So it's a novelty that they're together, but they're not wrestling like the young upstarts from the tag team renaissance in 2000. They're wrestling like two guys who have been singles guys for the last, 4 years, and now are kind of, hey, they're brothers, let's have them wrestle again. So, yeah, I agree with you. They don't feel like a tag team anymore. Not a unified tag team. You know, what do you think, Tim?
Yeah, and I actually really enjoy that because it almost feels like Eminem in some ways mirror them in that they are the young upstart tag team, even though they've been for a while, and they've got the girl with them as well. They've got a unified look. They are hungry, and they're trying to prove themselves against the stalwart. So it could be, a feud with these two teams could be an awesome kind of passing the torch thing, but it's also something that you can throw to easily where you have the veterans versus the young upstarts who in a lot of ways aren't not like them from the beginning of their own career.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Yep. So there you go. So the Hardys get the win. It's actually the longest match on the show. Almost, 24 change. Close to 25 minutes. And let's see, officially, 22:36.
Is that like half the show, I think?
25 I know, minutes. Seems, 25 minutes.
At least almost at
30. Yeah. Do we go backstage? No. Not yet, right? We have a couple of backstage segments. Yeah, yeah. I don't think not yet. All right. Next up, now we get to the lack of depth. And the sad thing is, when we talk about this lack of depth, there are some ECW stalwarts here that fans get into. It's just the problem is that you're filling the gaps with
this crowd was such trash. We'll talk about that later. I really think if this card, we'll talk about it. I feel like it's like not the worst if it was in front of the right audience. This audience was not the way to go with what they did, but we'll talk about it. I thought in some ways it was, it was like good the way they showcased, but here we go.
All right. He took a break from watching those WNBA pitches. And, all right. That, of course, is the pride of Nutley, New Jersey. And that, of course, being Balls Mahoney, the former Santa Claus. Taking on a newcomer, although not a newcomer in the sense
for us,
to the promotion
for a while,
but he's been around for a while. Tell us about him.
History teacher Matthew K. Every kiss begins with K. Began a side career in wrestling back in 2000. Worked training under Johnny Rods, the unpredictable one. Would work the indie scene in a plethora of promotions as Matt Stryker, in addition to working in education. But his worlds collided in 2004 when he landed a full-time social studies job at Queens High School. Kay didn't want to give up his dream job either, so he continued to wrestle on vacations and weekends. Things blew up for him in 2005 when Kay suddenly resigned after a school investigation discovered he had used 11 sick days to wrestle in Japan. I think Stan Hansen did the same thing back in the day. I don't know. Kay claimed that he thought the days he took were considered personal days. But after the superintendent recommended he be fired or not considered for future jobs, Kay said, "I'm out," and resigned anyway. Taking advantage of the notoriety he received, he was able to parlay a job with the WWE. He debuted on the 224.05 SmackDown, accepting Kurt Angle Invitational Challenge under the name Matt Martell. Vanished until June when he showed up again to challenge Angle. This time Angle outed him as the infamous fired New York City school teacher. Angle beat him that week, and again a week later when Martell showed up once more. After that, Martell was assigned to Deep South Wrestling, where he began to develop his new heel persona of a douchebag school teacher, resurfaced on the 212 Raw, hosting a talk show known as Matt Stryker's Classroom, wrestled sporadically on Raw until August of 06 when he was moved to ECW. So a guy's been around for a while, Scott. We're just kind of getting to him now. This event also marks the final appearance of Balls Mahoney. Remained active with the company until being released on April 28th, 2008. So he actually hangs around for quite a while.
Wow.
Working on ECW and SmackDown. After leaving, Mahoney went back to the indie scene and, of course, sadly passed away last year, 2015. So
was it this year? No, it was this year. April 12th of this year at the age of 44.
Jeez, it seems like so long ago. So many deaths this year. Timothy, what did you think of the Matt Stryker thing? And did you always find it funny how there were two Matt Strykers out there? It was like the other one passed away too, right? Didn't he? Was he get hurt?
No,
in the
I
ring
think
or
he doesn't wrestle anymore.
I think of someone else. All right.
The unibrow, or the, if you want to not be as, I guess, incendiary, the Les Thatcher Matt Stryker, as he's called. I think he just stopped wrestling. I don't think he died, but I might be wrong. But I mean, what do I know? Because when you said Bombs Mahoney died right here, I was kind of shocked because I thought of him as like a cockroach. I figured he had died almost 5 or 6 years ago. And every time I heard that he was still, every time I heard he was still alive, I was shocked. So now that I hear that he's dead, I'm even more shocked. Yeah, I thought Stryker actually, I'm going to just, just out myself as being ridiculous. I watched about a month worth of TV before the pay-per-view and the pay-per-view. And I saw that Stryker was like getting the most heat out of anybody on the brand, on the TV. And then it kind of plays back into what you said, Justin, this crowd just sucks,
right?
Because he gets almost no heat here. And the character was working really well on the TV as a guy that everyone hated. And I even kind of liked everything about the whole kind of his pre-match promo. I thought the, extremely enforced rules match was was kind of a funny little shtick, and his promo skills were good. He's smooth. And knowing that at one point they called him Matt Martell makes sense to me, because I think he's a guy who could have done a, Rick Martell model gimmick, in that he looks really well put together. I'm not saying necessarily I find him attractive. He's not my type per se, but he looks like a guy that you could see would be like, oh, that's a good looking dude. He's got his hair trimmed. He's, takes care of himself. So I could see him definitely doing that. An optimum word choice used there with your description of him, though, was his worlds collide, thinking of that old WCW AAA or CMLL pay-per-view, because Matt Thicker just recently did terrible commentary on a AAA pay-per-view the last weekend. So it was kind of a perfect little nod to his current work, mentioning that now. I don't know if you want to get into the match or just the Stryker stuff to begin with, but I thought Stryker, really, this crowd did him no favors, but he's a guy who just can elicit amazing heat, and he still to the day elicits amazing heat from the wrestling Twitter, be it on purpose or as an accident. He does a great job of it.
Yeah, let's talk about the match now. So Stryker still establishing the character, doing a fine job. Like you said, getting himself over. It was a natural heel in this world of ECW, the way things are going, and a perfect guy for like Taz to shit on and everything else. So I agreed with you. I loved him laying out the rules before the match, saying no foul language. That was funny. Balls, I thought he was a good fit for the new ECW. I thought he's a big enough name to fill out the card, but low enough to put guys over and not be... he's not going to out-pop other guys, but he's going to get a pop. Like, he's a perfect fit for what they were trying to do. Stryker's tights are absurd, by the way. Super snug, and his face on his ass, which always makes me laugh. Balls works clean, tries to grab the leg and takes things to the mat, as Joey talks about his amateur background. Balls leapfrogs, and Stryker can't believe it, and that's followed by Balls grabbing an arm breaker. Stryker comes back with a big right hand and then dodges a charge as Balls careen into the post shoulder first. Stryker hits an armbar takedown and goes to work on the shoulder. Matt keeps using different holds to work the joint as Balls keep trying to punch his way out of it. Stryker grabs an arm breaker, but Balls fights free, comes back with a series of punches and a sit-out powerbomb for the win. I thought the finish was really weird. It just came out of nowhere, and there was no build. And for a card that's super short that needed to eat up time, like, I feel like they were just kind of getting going, and then the match just ends. And I also thought Stryker should have won. Like, he looked really good. His promo was really good. On TV, he was getting over. He could have really been elevated nicely. Balls is going nowhere fast. In a way, I guess it's a nice career achievement for him to get this win, but I really thought Stryker is a guy on this card looking up and down the roster that had some potential to move up quickly. And I thought him getting a win here could have been nice, especially with a guy like Balls is going nowhere. I thought the match again was building nicely before the ending. Stryker's a good heel. It almost, you mentioned Rick Martel, but he almost reminded me too of the Genius in this role, like, where he's smart and eloquent and very over the top with his moves and holds, where everything's very well pronounced, his hands, his facial mannerisms, everything was very over the top, and it reminded me a lot of the Genius when he would wrestle. So I actually enjoyed this. Like, I thought it was one of the better matches on the card, and I thought they worked okay together. I liked Balls buying into the not cheating thing, and to me, that's where it would have played out perfectly, to have Stryker cheat to win. Like, Balls plays it clean and the Stryker fucks him and cheats and wins. I think that would have been the right way to go. But what did you think of the match, Scott, and then the ending?
The match was the match is okay. I think I might have to agree with you about Stryker. I will say this: the crowd was more into this match than I thought. Even with a fan favorite like Balls, because the crowd's been kind of half-assed. I think there was another thing Vince wanted to get out of. Having in this like little shit box in the middle of nowhere.
I get why they had it here. It's like a tribute, and I think ECW used to run here, right? Timothy, didn't they used to have shows here?
not in that building, but I know that they ran a few shows in kind of Atlanta, Georgia areas and stuff. So it's not uncommon, but I mean, not many. If any, it was one or two.
Okay.
But anyway, yeah. My point was, I think they tried to tie it in to do the small arena in the remote area, like to pay tribute to ECW. This crowd just wasn't cooperating.
No, it wasn't. No. Striker's tights were ridiculous. I mean, I don't know where he got them from. Were they from like 8 years ago? That's, you know, and the fact that, and Taz kept commenting that his fucking face and his ass were like crack in the middle. So it was like kept folding. It was really funny. And again, there's really not much more to say. The match isn't awful. It's not great. The Mahoney thing with Mike Knox and Kelly Kelly kind of fizzled out by this point. So yeah, I agree with you that Striker probably could have won the match here. I don't think there would have been any problem with that if he was a guy that they were looking to push for something legitimate with the company, you know,
I mean,
with the
like
promotion.
There's like 0.3% chance that Balls Mahoney's getting a push. I don't see the point of him winning other than you want to give him like a lifetime achievement or just to give the crowd some kind of pop.
Yeah. No, I think Striker should have won here. Look, Balls is old school, but Vince is got his handprint on this, then obviously half these, you know, scrubs are nothing but fodder for him. So I would have more than assumed that that he should have put Striker over, and he didn't. So what did you think, Tim?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you guys, and I think that the idea of Balls Mahoney, especially in this match where they say it's extremely enforced rules, but in the context of the new ECW that's more cleaned up, he is a guy who you could still push as a, you know, semi-legendary figure from old ECW, but the reason why he can't get out of the stumbling blocks is the rules and the new format, and he's not just throwing hard chair shots, and he may be good enough on the mat to hold his own, but that was never how he won matches before. So that's an easy out to let this guy just soak up losses, and you keep protecting him until, you know, he can beat scrubs or jobbers here and there to keep some credibility, but when he loses to big time guys because they outclass him, you know, wrestling like Striker does here, working, focusing on the arm, going after him, it's an easy story to tell. Justin, you even hitting the cheating to win at the end is so perfect and something I should have instantly thought of. And then you have him win with a move that in ECW they used to call the ball buster because it's like a sit-out spine buster thing. It's a joke on his name being Balls, but you can't even say it on pay-per-view. They don't let Joey Styles say ball buster. So then what's the point of using the move? Yeah. You know, it's so dumb. And then the trunks, I was sitting there thinking, couldn't they have got him some trunks that fit, especially if they're going out of their way to put, you know, that his face is on his ass? And I thought about it, and it's so Vince McMahon to say, let's get some tighter trunks so that your face is going, you know, into your crack so that they can make a joke saying that you have your head up your ass. You know, that sounds like a Vince McMahon joke, but
show
I never hear it actually
dick.
Made on. Yeah, yeah, exactly. They never actually go with it on commentary, so it just kind of the joke is lost, I guess, or maybe it wasn't ever even intended. But I think when you have a issue with depth on the heel side, that with Big Show leaving, your number two heel now is Bob Holly, who gets no heat, and your number one heel is Test. I think that, you know, burying a mid-card heel like Striker here, who's actually getting heat on a big show, is really just counterproductive for the future of the brand. But that obviously plays into if they even cared about the brand going down the line.
And I don't think they did, but
no. Yeah, exactly.
No, they really didn't. There was no need for I think.
But if they were, Striker was a guy.
Huh?
If they were, Striker was a guy they could have used.
Oh yeah, yeah, no, definitely. But instead they, you know. And again, Vince wanted to use these scrubs as fodder, and instead, you know, I guess this was the whole fans want to be happy. Fuck that Balls guy. So I don't know. So Balls Mahoney gets the win. The match is okay. We go backstage, JR, and this it's just par for the course.
Sabu unconscious. Loaded onto a stretcher.
Really?
Magnetics.
What a shock.
I know, right? I didn't really think of that. I guess it was kind of a shooty thing, Pop, probably having him being asleep on the floor. Heyman shows up yelling about not having him for the main event now. The crowd immediately is chanting bullshit because they know exactly where this is going. So another fan favorite taken out of the main event here to piss off the fans. But, yeah, you can see like things circling the drain as we move throughout the night. Sabu stuff not helping at all.
No. Not at all. Which brings us to our next match, our second tag team match of the evening. Another match between old ECW stalwarts and a pair of newcomers, JR. Who are the newcomers?
They are, sir. First, we'll start with Sylvester Turkai, a national champion collegiate wrestler.
Anybody say his name without giving us without a straight face? Sylvester the great Turkey. Sylvester Turkai.
They eventually turned pro, training with Rick Bassman out in California. In 2001, he was signed to a WWE developmental deal. After a short stint in OVW, Turkai was released and decided to head to Japan. Competed in both the pro wrestling and MMA games out in the Far East, where he would remain for several years. 2006, Turkai re-signed with WWE, making a quick stop in OVW, and then debuting on the 7/28/06 SmackDown, portraying an MMA-style fighter seconded by a corner man, Elijah Burke. After a strong run on Friday nights, Turkai and Burke were shifted to ECW on 11/7. Over the next 2 months, the two men started to switch roles, with Turkai acting as more of a bodyguard, and Elijah, who started to compete in the ring. After making an appearance on the 1/17 ECW, Turkai was surprisingly released the next day, returned to California to train a bit more, currently works the Japanese pro circuit, as of the time that we wrote this. Elijah Burke, a former police officer and amateur boxer, signed a WWE developmental deal in 2004, eventually won the OVW heavyweight title, and actually had a chance to move up to the main roster as part of the New Spirit Squad, but he turned it down. Kind of a diversity thing, I'm guessing. At 7/28, he finally arrived on SmackDown as a second for Sylvester Turkai and started working himself when they switched roles in ECW. Also, the final appearance for the FBI on 1/18, Tony Mamaluke was released from his contract, headed to the Indies, and had a run at TNA eventually. With the dissolution of the group, Little Guido remained with a promotion in a singles role under his old name of Nunzio, and Trinity would hang around as well. Timothy, what do you know about Turkai? Anything? I mean, just a guy that seemed just, like he had the look and kind of credentials to maybe hang around for a while, and I remember being pretty surprised when they phased him out.
Yeah, I thought it was an awkward transition to going from, you know, Elijah being the mouthpiece to Turkai being the kind of bodyguard role behind him wrestling, because it really felt like Elijah had the credentials, as they said, like amateur boxer, decent athlete, and could talk, that it was like, well, what's the point of him having this big kind of muscled up second, where Turkai really did need someone with charisma to help him, because I think that was his biggest issue. He felt like a guy who kind of was putting it together in the ring, though. I don't think he was terrible, except for really early on, he was quite awkward, as a lot of the guys that are kind of built like that and used to shoot fighting were back in the day. Took him a step or two to get used to it. But he seemed like he was going to get there, and it felt like they really did pull the plug on him way quicker than they should have. And it's almost like odd to see which guys get that treatment where they're done with them so fast, while other guys, they give them shot and shot again. I mean, how many like retreads were there for Heidenreich, and then Turkai gets one shot and he's done. It was very odd to me. I don't know much about his shoot background. I'd never looked into it at all. He always felt like a guy who I thought maybe they inflated his shoot background, or even just flat out made it up. I don't know if it's even real, but based on your biography, there was something to it. So I'm not sure about, like, yeah, his shooting, the shooting aspect of him.
All right, let's talk about the match here. Again, the pairing there, the straight shooting badass and the brash mouthpiece, who can slug out as well. FBI in the same position as Balls, good cred to be in these spots, but can take losses to the new stars. Trinity with FBI wearing a very revealing outfit that Taz just lusts over, like, throughout the whole match.
Yes.
Not her face, though. Burke and Guido start off with Burke controlling on the mat until Guido takes over and tags out to Tony. Tony grabs a side headlock and the FBI double team and quick tag while working the arm. Turkai comes in, but Tony avoids the charge and tags out. Guido leaps off the top but gets caught. Turkai chucks him down onto Mamaluke on the floor. Crowd is pretty flat here, outside of a couple of pockets of noise. Turkai manhandles Guido before tagging in Burke, who shows off some of his boxing skills. Guido gets caught in the wrong corner, clobbered with a forearm that leads to a two count. Turkai comes in, lands a big round kick to the head, and then Burke hits a running knee to the head with a clothesline leg sweep combo for two. Turkai comes back in, but Guido makes a tag. The FBI effectively double team, fight off both guys, and then Burke hits Tony with the experience to get the win. Turkai hits a muscle buster on Guido after the bell. I thought it was fine. Burke and Turkai should have had a long run as a team, or at least a pairing. Could have added some depth to a division that desperately needed it. And again, good use of the FBI, similar to what Ball should have been, I think, earlier in the night. I thought this was perfect use of these ECW veterans to put over the young guys. So, again, a fine tag match. And I think a lot of the stuff on this card is fine. It's just it's fine for, like, TV. Like, not to carry a pay-per-view. Like, two of these matches, okay. But this is all, like, easy Express Line TV stuff that's being sold to you as a full pay-per-view. Like, this 6.5-minute match being one of the key matches on the pay-per-view is just doesn't help things. But what do you think, Scott?
Well, first off, I know I continuously say it, and I'm going to continue to say it, but the FBI is just not the FBI without Sally Gratz. I'm sorry. I don't know why. I don't know where he was, if he was still driving, if he was making pizzas or whatever, but the FBI without Sally Gratz.
You need that joint that you go to in Brooklyn. What was it?
Oh, L&B Spumoni Gardens. Wouldn't surprise me. Point two, step two, are Joe, I mean, seriously, it's another match. Are Joey and Taz drunk? I mean, Taz is like just a disaster. I don't know what his problem is. He's lusting over the women. I don't know if they were half-assing it because they felt that everybody else was. I don't know. But the two of them just were not in their game on this night. And thirdly, you can clearly tell who the star was because they had Elijah Burke get the win, with his finisher and not Turkai. So I think right. It was pretty evident that Burke was transitioning.
Deep down somewhere in Vince's loins, he wished that these guys were combined into one person because all of his dreams, the talker and Burke with the legit background and then the size and look of Turkai, I'm sure he wished
that
there was just one big giant man.
Giant man with giant ponytail, giant beard. But yeah, the match is all right. I don't know. What do you think, Tim?
Yeah, no, match is fine. And to speak to the commentary, I think Taz a lot of times with Joey has this weird combative thing where you can't even tell. I can't even tell if he's trying to play a gimmick, and sometimes it makes for awkward silences where Joey doesn't know what to do. I mean, the Muscle Buster when they're playing the replay afterwards, and Taz goes like, "I don't know what you even call something like that," and Joey just says, "I believe it's called a Muscle Buster," and then Taz has to be like, "I know what it's called, Joey. Don't tell me. It was a rhetorical question," and it's like. That wasn't necessary. Like, that little extra barbs back and forth just makes the whole thing feel kind of unprofessional and awkward. And it's
right.
Not playful and fun in any way. It's just kind of taking away from the match. As Taz talks about, the Brooklyn blood is what makes the Trinity look so hot. And I'm like, I guess.
Do you think he carried that over from, like, his Cole time, like the combativeness?
Yeah, and it played well with Cole. Yeah. It's so true. It was. It played well with Cole because... I don't know, Cole is kind of at the time was kind of a geek, and it's okay to have Taz pick on him, but Joey is, you know, the guy from ECW who's, he would only back down from, like, the Dudley Boys, and everything else he would always hold his own, and he didn't mind having a smart mouth with every other wrestler. He wouldn't, you know, kind of shut up or know when it was time not to say something. He would always say something, and here he kind of bites his tongue, it feels like, and it just leads to weird, like, conversations that just drop off, or he feels like he can't say certain things to Taz because Taz is going to act upset about it. And I don't even know at this point, I'm not supposed to take Taz really seriously as a badass anymore. Why am I supposed to think that he's scared of him?
It's definitely a Vince thing. He looks at this like little nerd. It's like, there's no way you're standing up to these guys, you know?
Yeah, exactly. The match is fine, but it really is the FBI. Even though it's different members, the FBI matches are always awkward, and they worked in ECW because the fan base was so invested. But the problem with FBI is it's like they're good wrestlers. They do zany, funny, fun spots that the crowd can all pop for and get used to. But they're usually placed as being the heels in the match. And all the things just kind of don't mesh well to put the match together. And then you add in the fact that they're going up against Elijah Burke and Turkai, who should definitely be the heels in this setting just because of, you know, their act is. And it comes across like FBI are a little bit kind of underhanded. They're using a couple double team tactics here and there. They've got the girl on the outside, but I think you're supposed to cheer them. They're hitting like their normal spots, and the crowd just isn't invested at all. This crowd at this point is completely dead. So the match is fine, but it's not a pay-per-view match. And I think that's the biggest kind of the condemnation you can lay at the feet of this match is just that this shouldn't be on a pay-per-view. It doesn't feel like it should be on a pay-per-view at all. The only person who brought their pay-per-view game was Trinity wearing a dress where she's half naked.
I would agree.
Yeah.
I would agree totally with that. I mean, you know, 6 minutes, four, you know, all these matches, like, oh my God, it's Express Line. Like, they couldn't get out of this arena quick enough on this night. That's what it feels like to me. Like, they're just... This needs to end. We want to fire Paul Heyman and reboot this whole brand, and we just want to get the fuck out of here. We're sorry that we even have to do this show. Like, that's what it felt like to me at times.
We're sorry we have to even be here.
Like, we're angry that we even booked this stupid show. We want nothing to do with any of these people.
Yeah, it's the how dare you show up to the crowd. Like, that's how they're treating the crowd. Like,
right.
Who made you come here? What are you thinking? And we're going to shit on you and give you a bad show for even having the audacity to show up here.
I mean, if you really want to be cynical, you could say Vince sandbagged this whole pay-per-view just so he could fire Heyman. like he knew that everything he put on was going to bomb, if you would think that he was more self-aware. But the fact that he thinks everything he does is gold makes me think, no, he really thought this shit was going to work, and then scapegoated Heyman for getting him to the spot. And I don't think Heyman is purely innocent in all this either. I mean, we can talk about the end of the night, I guess. But, you know, I think some of this was on him. But anyway, what's next, Scott?
Yes, so there you go. So,
actually, we go backstage again. Sabu gets taken out in an ambulance officially as CM Punk and RVD look on. Crowd not.
And the crowd is chanting bullshit the whole time.
Right. Crowd status, yeah, you're not happy.
No, because you know what's coming. Yeah. So there you go. And Elijah Burke and Mr. Terkai win the match. All right. Our next match. It's another one that I... God. Another ECW.
A lot of flurries on this night. Just single snowflakes coming down. That's about it.
I know. Another ECW original taking on, not really a newcomer. I mean, he's been with the company for a little bit. He's been a manager and a valet or whatever for a few guys. But now he's actually showing his wrestling chops. JR, who is it?
On 10/21, Daivari and Great Khali made their debut on ECW. However, now Daivari would be the one in the ring. Khali was his muscle at ringside, doing his best to assault Daivari's opponents when given the chance.
Genius move.
Yes. On 11/14, Tommy Dreamer defeated Daivari by DQ, and Khali interfered and attacked Dreamer on the floor, shoving him crotch first into the post and dropping him with a tree slam. Good, Scott. Elaborate on that, because I thought it made a lot of sense to switch these guys around. Remember,
well, there's no doubt.
People were saying that back in the Daivari and Hassan days, that Daivari should have been one in the ring. Khali is the bodyguard instead of being in the ring makes all the sense in the world.
No, absolutely. This guy should not be wrestling 7-8-minute matches. There's no doubt about it. I think, sadly, The Undertaker had to be the scapegoat or the guinea pig for that deal. No, this makes perfect sense. You know, Daivari's a good worker. He's a great worker. Got a little bit of his own personality anyway, so it works better. Khali, he's just a big, you know, that guy's in great shape. I mean, he's got a good look. He's just a, you know, bumbling oaf. He can't wrestle. It's pretty simple. So this works out perfectly. This is exactly the way it should be. Unfortunately, it's not on SmackDown. It's on ECW. And the minute I remembered him coming down, I'm like, oh, my God. And takes on, as mentioned, ECW original Tommy Dreamer. But, yeah, this makes perfect sense. You need to flip-flop him. Daivari's the better wrestler. It's pretty cut and dry.
What do you think of that, Timothy?
Yeah, the problem is just that, I mean, Khali is a pretty expensive paycheck for a guy to just stand there and be big. It's like, that's the biggest issue with him. It's just, he can't work, but I don't think you can kind of justify that paycheck for a guy to just stand around. And he never showed any signs of improving is the biggest issue. So it's just, I think they should have cut bait with him a lot sooner than they did. Seeing as I think he only got fired maybe 3 or 4 years ago at the most. And they're even talking about bringing him back. This match is, I mean, fine, but quick. I really didn't like the finish at all. I thought the finish was kind of ridiculous, but I think the best part is, Khali getting ejected, and he seems to not understand that he's getting ejected. It takes him like a solid, you know, couple minutes for him to understand that the ref is telling him to even leave. Yeah, the referee's pointing at him, and he just points back. He's like, no, you. It's like, what are you talking about? This guy has just no clue about what's going on, and, I think even when they tried to make him into a dancing goof, in some ways he's almost so self-unaware that he can't even be self-deprecating enough to make even like a goofy gimmick work. So, yeah, I mean, this is another one. I can't buy it as a pay-per-view match. I don't know. It wasn't bad. Daivari's a guy who I've always been semi-high on. I think that they kind of got rid of him too soon. And, mm-hmm. and now you see his brother possibly coming in, and hopefully he gets a better shot than Daivari did himself. But all in all, you know, another match where it's just like, what, at this point, I'm starting to not blame the crowd for being so dead at this point, because what are you giving them? You know, you're not giving them anything.
We've crossed a vortex in the middle of the graph here where, like, the crowd was at fault for a while, and now we've hit the center point. Now it's the other way around where there's a reason the crowd sucks, and they're not being brought back to life. But so Dreamer gets a nice reception. It kind of feels weird he's not in the main event. But again, we get the old vet versus the up-and-comer. Dreamer controls early, tosses Daivari to the floor with a hip toss as Taz wonders if Sabu can make it back. Daivari cracks Tommy and knocks him to the floor, hits a baseball slide, but Dreamer slings him into the barricade outside. Back inside, Dreamer hits a suplex, but Khali hooks the rope as Tommy charges and tumbles outside. Ref tosses Kali as Daivari starts to work the neck and upper back. Dreamer fights to his feet to break a chin lock and then falls back on Daivari. Crowd starts to really be flat here as Tommy slugs his way back into control, hitting an inverted DDT for two. Daivari goes back to the eyes to block a Death Valley driver and then heads up top and whiffs on a cross body. Tommy hangs him in the tree of woe and hits a dropkick to the face. Daivari blocks a DDT and gets a roll up in tights for the cheap win. I thought this was about as bland as you can get. Through the motions completely, and it was very sad in ways, like, to just even see this out there on pay-per-view. Just, it felt like a training match. I don't know. It was bad. Dreamer chases Daivari to the back. Kali shows up and drops Tommy on the grating with a tree slam. And fuck that, too. It's like, on this shit show, you make Tommy take a bump like that for no reason. Like, you're not getting any additional heat. The crowd doesn't care. Just call the audible. And I thought Tommy should have squashed Daivari here to wake up the crowd. I thought you have Kali get involved early, send him to the back, and then Tommy just kicks the shit out of Daivari. Wake the crowd up a bit. I mean, they are dead here. The crowd is so flat. No energy of what ECW was and how it was, you know, used to be special. The crowd is blah. The match is a blah. And I think you're selling Daivari as a guy that relies on Kali. So if Kali gets thrown out to me, let Dreamer get the win, pop the crowd, it's his night, whatever. I know it's diametrically opposed to what I said earlier. I just saw Stryker, A, as having more in the tank than Daivari. B, the gimmick of Daivari is to be relying on Kali. And C, Dreamer, in my mind, is up the pecking order for Balls Mahoney. So that's my justification why I thought they should have flipped the results of these two matches, let Dreamer get the feel-good win on the big ECW pay-per-view and try and wake up this crowd just a bit. What do you think, Scott?
You pretty much hit the nail on the head for all of this. First, 30 seconds into this match, and you already know it's going to suck. I mean, it's all about Kali, who's... I didn't realize Kali was technically an ECW guy. I thought he was just there for...
Yeah, no,
I
think they both jumped over.
I thought he was technically still SmackDown, only Daivari was ECW. Once Kali left, I thought the match picked up a little bit. But you're right, though. It did really feel like a training match.
Yeah, it's like they didn't give a shit. They were just like, and I don't think that was a dude. Well, I don't know if Tommy already knew what was going on with Heyman. He might have been mailing it in, I guess.
I mean, he might have been pissed off and just kind of went with the emotions and whatever. You know, let Daivari win. I don't really give two shits. I mean, whatever. At first,
well, I heard or read somewhere that before this, Tommy and someone else who I can't remember now, possibly Sabu, had asked for their release already. So Tommy may have been already wanting to go.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And thirdly, again, like I agree with you. Not sure if Daivari winning was the right choice, but at this point, who really gave a shit? To be honest with you.
No, yeah, of course not.
who really
I'm looking at
cared.
It more from the point of view of, like, the crowd on this night may have been a little better if Tommy won. Like,
yeah,
long
Tommy
term,
won, I think there might have been a spike.
The brand is shit anyway, but at least maybe the crowd could have been more into it if he won.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think Tommy winning might have done something for somebody. you know, but so Daivari wins. Kali forces Dreamer to take a stupid bump, and let's just get out of this. It's just nothing more to say.
What do you think, Tim?
Unless Tim, you had anything to add.
The last thing is just they use it later, so maybe they, you know. But I think this is the spot where they should have done the Sandman trope that they were running at ECW, where Sandman just comes out and canes the shit out of everybody. And I think they should have just not even ejected Kali. They should have done it even before that point and just had Sandman come out and cane the shit out of Kali too, and that might have gotten the crowd into it. Because I think this was the point where the lull, like you said, this is where they passed the point of no return. So when they do have him come out later, I think it was too late. And this, if they had done it here, they might have been able to save it, possibly. But that's like my final thought.
Yeah. No, it's entirely possible. But like JR said, I think everybody had checked out at this point. So there you go. Daivari gets the win. Now to really drop another shit bomb on the crowd, JR, we go backstage.
And you knew this was coming because they... Timothy, I'll give you a take because you watch the TV, but Heyman shows up and he offers Sabu slots to Hardcore Holly. A real kick in the nuts to ECW fans. I mean, Holly's worked hard since switching the brands. Like, he fit in fine, but, I mean, they clearly... I mean, this is just a slap in the nuts. Like, to pull out Sabu and put fucking Bob Holly in the match. And Heyman had wanted Holly originally, but Lashley took the spot from him. We'll talk about that later, so... You kind of knew this was maybe coming, and I think it was rumored too, especially when Sabu had his trouble backstage. But Timothy, was there hints of this, of how things were building you know, it seemed like they were teasing Holly, right?
Yeah, it was going to be Holly was going to be the last guy, and Lashley stole his spot. And then they did the next week. It was Holly versus RVD, and whoever won got that spot. So Holly could have won RVD. So they had already twice teased that Holly was going to be in the chamber. And another report that I read was it wasn't supposed to be Holly replacing Sabu until the very last minute, which I think was another one where, like you said, it really felt like a kick in the nuts. If they had done almost anyone else as the replacement for Sabu, it would have been fine. But you've already teased this guy twice, and he's just not getting over as a heel at all at this point. It just wasn't – or at least not as a top-level heel.
Right. He could have been lower in the card and been fine.
Yeah, but I just don't see anybody taking hardcore Bob Holly seriously at this point. Not at this point.
Right.
You know, he had his shots before, and every time he kind of blew it. So I think it was just too late.
No, he needed more rehab for sure to be up to this point. Put him earlier in the night, you know. Throw Tommy in this match. Mix it up a bit. But, yeah, just they were trying. I mean, he was working hard. But, yeah, his cachet was so low. But whatever, the whole brand was. I don't know what they were trying to do at this point.
Get out of the show.
Yeah, it still plays into your theory that it's an intentional tank job and that they're just trying to have, you know, a scapegoat reason to fire Heyman, because it almost feels that way for just how bad it is.
Yeah, or I feel like they were caught between what they wanted to be. Like, did they want to be developmental? Did they want to be a brand? I don't know. It's hard to say. I don't know if they were ever happy with being on Sci-Fi, to be honest. Like, I feel like they hated that from the start. And that they were mad that USA put them there. Like, I feel like everything has just been snowballing to where they hated everything. And I think they turned their mind around. It's 07 comes. We'll talk about it. But for now, anyway, they're not happy.
Yeah, it's pretty atrocious. Next up, our final match of the undercard. Finally through this. We have the ongoing we actually have a romance storyline on ECW, which was already a fucking slap in the face to begin with, unless it's, you know, Tommy Dreamer and two chicks making out. Nobody really wanted to see this. Taking on a gimmick that I don't even think Heyman would have done this if he got paid to do it in 1996, but tell us about all of these fine characters, JR.
Well, if you're talking about the vampire thing, they were kind of catching on. When did Twilight come out?
The first one? Do the description, and I will let you know.
Look that up. Just look in your DVD shelf. We last saw Kevin Ferdig on pay-per-view under the name Mordecai.
You got to check the bookcase.
Check it out. After a brief run and a quick flame out in 04, Ferdig was eventually released by WWE in July of 05 after hanging around OVW for a year. He would work the indie circuit as Mordecai over the next year before being re-signed in June of 06. Ferdig was giving a new look, a modern-day vampire, and new name Kevin Thorne, assigned to ECW. Over the first month of ECW's existence, Thorne was featured in brief vignettes consisting of him staring into the camera and spitting blood. Vignettes of a tarot card reader named Ariel also started to air around this time. Rumors swirled that Thorne and Ariel would be joined by former vampire of the WWF Gangrel and a new faction of vampires inhabiting ECW. And of course, again, tying in with the sci-fi stuff. Gangrel never surfaced. Thorne and Ariel debuted as a duo on 725. Announcer Joey Styles worked hard to put over the gimmick, saying how they frequented bike clubs and lived in a vampire lifestyle. After a feud with Balls Mahoney, Thorne transitioned into this feud with Mike Knox. Using a modeling career as a springboard, Shelly Martinez broke into the wrestling business in 2000, training and working in Southern California under the name Desiree, or Desire, one of the two. She would work under a variety of names in different territories before signing with WWE and being assigned to OVW in April of 05. Worked some unique gimmicks and feuds while in OVW and was well prepared when she was brought in as a tarot card reading vampire valet for Kevin Thorne. This would be Ariel's only pay-per-view match, but she will still appear on pay-per-views into mid-07. Anything on the vampire, Scott, before our next one?
By the way, this is not my copy. It's definitely Dan McGinn's.
Yes.
But no. The first Twilight came out November 17th to... Oh, wait a minute. That's the LA premiere. How about the national one? November 21st, 2008.
All right. So they were ahead of the game.
They were ahead of the...
They're either way behind or ahead. So whatever. However you want to look at it.
Yes. I'm going to give on it that they were behind on the interview with the vampire.
But I feel like the bike club stuff was prominent at this time, like the goth vampire culture. I'm not
no, yeah, it was. I actually I have some familiarity with it because I always thought that goth chicks were hot, so I had to hang out around them, unfortunately. And there were a lot of guys and girls that were pretending to be vampires at this time.
Okay. So, maybe
they're on point. Teller used to hang out with them, too, so.
Oh, God.
And they thought he was the Wolfman in Right Away.
He looks like he came out of a fucking crypt. But, yeah, I didn't mind the gimmick. I thought it fit because of the sci-fi thing and then the fact that it was kind of in vogue.
Yeah, it was fine.
Maybe they made them too vampire-ish and not gothy enough. Like, that's maybe one complaint you could say is that they took the ridiculous aspect of it. But, there's worse stuff with ECW to get upset about. Over the last couple of months, the relationship between Mike Knox and Kelly Kelly began to strain. As Kelly began openly displaying a crush on CM Punk, the notoriously jealous Knox didn't appreciate this and began to take his anger out on his girlfriend. As the weeks went on, Knox tried to jump Punk, but Punk usually stayed one step ahead of him. Things got worse. 10/31, when Kelly dresses Punk for Halloween, and Punk again thwarted Knox's attack. The next week, Punk defeated Knox in an Elimination Chamber qualifying match. Punk defeated Knox again the next week, with Kelly clearly cheering for Punk after the match, further pushing Knox closer to the edge. On 11/21, Kelly joined Punk at ringside for his match against Kevin Thorne. After the match, Thorne and Ariel attacked Punk and Kelly. After Punk ran them off, Kelly rewarded him with a hug as Knox looked on seething. Tough spot for Kelly, not ready to wrestle at all. Kelly wishes Punk luck in the main event, pissing off Knox. Thorne and Ariel, I thought was a good pairing. Like I mentioned, Ariel smoking hot here. First matchup of ECW up-and-comers. No ECW veterans in the mix. And basically, heel-heel. Right, Timothy? With the build, were these either of these teams, you know, hedging face? I guess Kelly was, but...
Yeah, Kelly was kind of the lone face of the outfit, or of this match.
Okay.
Okay, makes sense.
Thorne and Knox start things off with Thorne using the buckle to put down Knox. Knox recovers and hits a hard lariat, but Thorne comes back with a clothesline of his own, followed by more heavy blows. Knox hits a slam and then a big boot for two. Locks in a neck vise, but Thorne powers out and tags in Ariel. Knox tags in Kelly, who's very trepidatious. Ariel meets her and hammers away before choking her in the ropes and with her boot. Crowd finally shows some signs of life when the chicks start fighting. And they get fired up when Knox refuses to tag Kelly and walks off, leaving her alone. Ariel keeps clobbering Kelly and grabs the win and then hammers on her again after the match. Sandman then comes out to the crowd and beats the shit out of Thorne with the cane, which the fans loved. I thought it was kind of weird to leave Sandman off the card. I know this was the shtick, but, you know, he's one of the most over guys they have, and this card is so thin, you'd think he could fit somewhere. Thorne runs away. Sandman drinks a beer. Nothing match besides having Knox screw over Kelly. Thorne had the size and the look, but is very bland. Ariel felt like a bigger star than everyone out there, I thought. I would have maybe just done Sand... I don't know what they could have done. Something with Sandman. Maybe have Knox and Thorne team against, like, Sandman and someone else, and then, you know, have Knox walk out on them and Thorne say... I mean, I don't know. Something different other than this heel-heel match. I'm thinking along the lines of, like, the Goldust and Mero thing back in, like, 98, where... They teamed, the women hated each other, but they were forced to work together, something like that. Just you get Sandman on the card.
Yeah, I would say, and then you just have Knox walk out as Thorne and Ariel turn on her kind of thing.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and then that does the same. You get the same purpose, but the match doesn't have to suck.
And you don't have to have Sandman come out and squash Thorne after the match. He gets the win, and then he looks like a clown anyway. But what did you think of this whole thing, Timothy?
I thought that if we were gonna give MVP awards or like even just in the context of working above what you would expect, it goes handily to Ariel.
Yes.
She gets the most reaction out of like almost anyone the whole night, and it does have to do with the fact that she's wearing a tiny skirt and a thong, and just really showing it off. But I also loved her kind of wrenching Kelly Kelly's hair on the top rope. I thought that was just kind of an interesting take on a spot that you don't really see very often. She's, you know, working really hard as just kind of a ridiculous heel. I think it was odd too. Kelly Kelly and Ariel looked so much different, you know, back then at this time. They just, it's crazy to think that they're probably both barely like 18 or something at this time, and they've both changed the way they look so much comparatively. Knox was okay, I think, towards that last run with the gigantic beard in ECW where he had really kind of gotten a lot more burly. He was a lot thicker. Mm-hmm. Here he just looks like, he kind of looks like a less disgusting version of Gene Snitsky at this point. He just really looks pointless.
I was going to say, like, Frazier's kind of lesser-known brother.
Yeah, exactly. The guy is just, he's kind of got some size. He's got no real personality, and he's in this match for a few seconds. Thorne is a guy who I like that you say that he's bland because they've put the most ridiculous gimmicks on him, you know, with right. Mordecai and then the vampire, and he still somehow always fails to have a leave a really big impression. And you'd expect a guy with his size, who, you know, he's not terrible in there, to have at least at some point made some kind of impact with these crazy wild characters, and he never does. And then there's another point here with the kind of contentiousness between Taz when Cole mentions that they like to, or no, not Cole, but Joey Styles mentions that they like to frequent bike clubs, and Taz interrupts him and is like, yeah, yeah, I know what they are. And it's like, Jesus Christ, Taz, like, well, there's no point to that one. But I thought all in all, I'd give big props to Ariel here. She looked good. And from what I remember, the original card, I think it was supposed to be Bob Holly. It was going to be Sandman versus Bob Holly.
Okay.
And they scrapped that match to put Bob Holly into the chamber.
Okay, man, that makes sense then. They should have had Holly work double duty.
Yeah, they should have.
Fill out the card a bit.
They should have kept Holly off and put Sandman in the chamber is what they should have done. But anyway, there you go. Ariel and Kevin Thorne win, but nobody wins because Sandman comes in and beats the shit out of them. So where's the heat at all? There really isn't any.
PTB Nation, it is now time for the Rob Houston Memorial Hacksaw Jim Duggan update.
I got my 2x4.
I could have made his ass a real man.
Vincent Kennedy McMahon Jr. here with your Hacksaw Jim Duggan update. December 06, he was banging Trinity while Taz sat in the corner and jerked off. Who gives a fuck? Griscolo, what's going on? Are you in labor? Is that what this day's about?
No, I'm not in labor. How are you, VKM?
I'm fucking great. Summer's over. Football's here. The XFL debuting this weekend on UPN. I can't fucking wait.
Yes, the Memphis Maniacs, goddammit. That's my pick.
Who's this fucking slob you got with you tonight?
This is Tim.
Oh! What are you, Kevin Kelly? You sound like a fucking dipshit.
I've been referred to as Kevin Kelly's coworker before, so I take it as a compliment that I sound like him and act like him.
So you work at the fucking garbage dump like he does? Timothy Buckner. That must make Scott Bill Buckner because he can't fucking bend over. What are you fucking idiots doing anyway? Hell, you should be out on a boat chilling. It's fucking the end of summer. You're sitting here in a studio talking about this garbage pay-per-view.
This is one of your favorites of all time.
No, it isn't. It's trash, just like your stupid show is trash. You should be out on the yacht with me and Armento.
Oh, boy.
Sipping champagne coolies.
You blasting the yacht rock? You singing some Ambrosia?
Oh, Yacht Rock, my favorite channel. I'm so excited they're keeping it around. Hey, Griscolo, I know you love the Yacht Rock. I don't know about you, Tim, but, you know, I threw together a little cassette tape for you. You want to check it out?
Absolutely.
All right, here we go. Hello, it's me. I've thought about us for a long, long time. Maybe I think too much, but something's wrong. There's something here that doesn't last too long. Maybe I shouldn't think of you as mine. That's how much I feel for you, baby. How much I need, how much I need your touch. How much I live for your loving. That's too much, that's how much. Aruba, Jamaica, ooh, I wanna take you to Bermuda, Bahama, come on, sexy mama, Key Largo, Montego, baby, why don't we go down to Kokomo? We'll get there fast and then we'll take it slow. That's where we want to go, way down in Kokomo, Montique,
that Monterey mystique. Ba-da-da-da-da-da-da. Ba-da-da-da-da. Sailing takes me away to where I'm home. Just a dream and the wind to carry me, and soon I will be free. First you say no, you've got some plans for the night, and then you stop and say, alright, life is kinda crazy with a spooky little bitch like you. Not your situation, I just need contemplation over you. I'm not so systematic, it's just that I'm an addict for your love. I don't like cricket. No, I know. I love it, that dreadlock holiday. I don't like reggae. Oh no. I love it, that dreadlock holiday. You think it was so easy? You used to say that it was so easy, but you're trying now. Heavenly Father, watching us fall. We take from each other and give nothing at all. Well, it's a doggone shame, but never too late for change. So if your luck runs low, just reach out and call his name. Yamo be there, up and oh, Yamo be there, up and oh, Yamo be there, up and oh, Yoko be there, whenever you call Jim Cornette. Think of you's working up my appetite. Looking forward to a little afternoon delight. Rubbing sticks and stones together makes those sparks ignite. And the thought of loving you's getting so exciting. Sky rockets in flight. Yes! Afternoon delight! Babe, stepping out into that night. Into the light, you babe, stepping out into the night, into the light. I'm not the only one that holds you. I never should have been the one to tell you, my only girl. I'm not the only one to hold you. I never ever should have told you you're my own the world. This is it. Make no mistake where you are. This is it. You're back to the corner. This is it. Don't be a fool anymore. This is it. The waiting is over. Is everything all right? I just called to say how lost I feel without you. Miles away. I really can't believe I'm near and how I still care about you. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Ba 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 blah blah blah. Doobie 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 doo da da. Last night I had the strangest dream. I sailed away to China in a little rowboat to find ya. And you said you had to get your laundry clean. What? didn't want no one to hold you, but what does that mean? You said, ain't nothing gonna break my stride. Nobody's gonna slow me down. Oh no, I've got to keep on moving. Ain't nothing gonna break my stride. I'm running and I won't touch ground. Oh no, I've got to keep on moving. She's just 16 years old. Leave her alone, they say. Separated by fools who don't know what love is yet. Want you to know, if I could fly, I'd pick Steph up, I'd take her into the night and show her a love like she's never seen. Ever seen. Oh. I keep forgetting we're not in love anymore. I keep forgetting things will never be the same again. I keep forgetting how you made that so clear. I keep forgetting I laid all the buses down, I let my gat explode. Now I'm switching my mind back into freak mode. If you want skirt, sit back and observe. Just left a gang of hoes over there on the curb. Ba-da-da-ba-da-ba-da! Ba-da-da-da-meow! Ba-da-da-da-meow! Meow! Meow! Ba-da-da-da-meow! Ba-da-da-da-da-boo! Maybe don't be late! I can hardly wait, I said to myself, when we're old, we'll go dancing in the dark, walking in the park and reminiscing. No need to ask, he's a smooth operator. Smooth operator. Smooth operator. He's a smooth operator. Coast to coast, LA to Chicago, Western Mail. Across the north and south to Key Largo, love for sale. I'll be back in the high life again. All the doors I close one time will open up again. I'll be back in that high life again. All the eyes that watched me once will smile and take me in. It's like having a dream where everybody hates Bret Hart. It's like having it all and watching it all fall apart. I would wait till the end of time for you, Steph, and do it again. It's true. You're a rich girl and you've gone too far, 'cause you know it don't matter anyway. You can rely on this old man's money. You can rely on this old man's money. It's a bitch, girl. It's gone too far, 'cause you know it don't matter anyway. Say money won't get you too far, too far, get you too far, get you fucking too far. Drink porridge, pudding pie. Kiss the girls and made them cry. Fuck the girls and make them cry. Bend them over and make them cry. Georgie, porgie, pudding pie. Bang those bitches and made them cry. Fuck those sluts and made them cry. Fuck Armento and his stupid eye. Fucking Georgie, porgie, pudding pie. Kiss the girls and made them cry. Fuck Mark Claire and his stupid hair. Fuck you, Criscolo, you stupid fuck. Fuck you, fuck you, fuck you all. Georgie, porgie's a fucking slob. Fuck Georgie, porgie and his stupid pie. Fuck all you and your stupid eyes. I fucking hate you all. Get off my fucking yacht. Fuck Dr. G and Woodling too. fuck Jack Campbell and Todd Weber. Moo. I don't even know what I'm saying anymore. Georgie, put in pie. Kissed those fuckers and made them cry. Yacht Rock.
That's a tremendous farewell to Yacht Rock proper, because we know it'll be all year now, JR, on Sirius XM. But unfortunately, it'll be, well, not unfortunately, but it'll be on, I think it's channel 312.
Yeah, I'm very sad Sirius because XM, so. In the car I have Sirius now, but it's the older radio. So
right.
Tomorrow I'm going to get in to go to work, and I will not be able to listen to Yacht Rock unless I use up my data on my phone. My other car, we have a newer Sirius radio, so I'll be able to listen to it there and still on the app at work, so I can continue being a 70-year-old man at work.
Yes, I wonder what, let's see. Oh, I know what 18 is going to be.
Stupid, back to his D'Amato would say, Roadhead Radio.
No, it's not Roadhead. No, I think the Garth Brooks channel starts.
Oh, God, even worse. Anyway.
Tomorrow, or Wednesday, or whatever. So.
So sad.
Yep.
But anyway,
no,
Roadhead
Radio is like on channel 315, I think, or something. Roadhead Radio.
We won the war, though, because Yacht Rock is staying around year-round. It took us about a year and a half to get there, but here we are.
That's right.
Greatest channel ever invented.
Yep, that's it. We blasted the two Twitters. Benny will live on. Yes. Damn it.
Hopefully.
Because Kelly Kelly looked like she was just 16 years old.
I'm interested in the yacht rocks that Vince has on the yacht, possibly smoking right now, on the party that he was talking about. So I may join him for some of those.
Very different kind of yacht rock. So, you know, we've been playing the Yacht Rock in and out of the breaks all summer, so we'll pick that back up next Memorial Day, Scott. But hope everyone enjoyed the Yacht Rock here on the Place to Be podcast.
Yep. And it'll get its farewell on main event this week as well. So, speaking of Kelly Kelly and being 16 years old, did we get the backstage interview yet with Bobby Lashley with Rebecca wearing a lot of nothing?
Oh, we may have, but I don't have a note to talk about it. God.
Holy crap. Yeah,
that came after the match. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, Bobby Lashley gets interviewed by Rebecca DiPietro, and they show a clip of, you know, him getting fucked with by Big Show and Heyman and those guys in the friggin', you know, SWAT outfits or whatever the hell it was. And she literally, I mean, literally has nothing on. She has this, like, white dress thing, kind of something Lita would wear with her cleavage, you know, flying out. The only difference is, you know, in WWE world, I don't know if Lita tapes them down or whatever, but you don't see whether it's cold in the building or not.
Right.
But in ECW, no, we do it raw.
So this even made Armento's mechanical heart stop.
Yes. Yeah, it was. He was the Tin Man there. Holy shit. Yeah, she was busting out everywhere. But
she's married to Josh Matthews. Is that the one? Have we talked about this before?
I feel like is she the one married to Josh Matthews? That I don't know. By the way, Sylvester Turkai retired from wrestling in 2012.
I think he retired in 2007. But okay.
retired in 2007, yes. That is true.
So she's actually from, and I thought this was true. She was born in Rehoboth, Massachusetts, resides in East Providence, Rhode Island. I thought, who the hell was it that was managing? I always think it's her. I guess it's not her. She did Hawaiian.
It's somebody.
Some hot chick was married to Josh Matthews.
Yeah, and I think she still might be, actually, unfortunately.
So Miss DiPietro is local to me.
That whole promo package to me with Lashley was ridiculous. They're both terrible, obviously, but they have a backstage interviewer ask Lashley a question only to go to a promo video where Lashley is talking. It just felt so awkward. Did you guys notice how strange that was?
Yes.
Yeah, I was just like, what is this? And then he cuts, like, you know, he drops two lines because they can't trust him to cut a full promo. And it's just ridiculous. But yeah, that whole part was just something else.
So even more reason to hate Josh Matthews. He was once married to Rude DeBoner.
Yes, Rude DeBoner. And now she's married. Now he's married to Madison Rayne.
Madison Rayne. What a shithead. Piece of
I know, really.
Fucking midget shit with his fucking midget shit. Wannabe voice.
That's right. all right. Let's end this fucking mess. Let's get to the chamber. Let's get to our main event. It is indeed an extreme elimination chamber for the ECW World Championship. Of course, we know your champion is still the Big Show from the 4th of July. Oh boy. lot of backstory here, JR. Yeah. Guys intertwining in and out. Give us the lowdown.
And for the record, I thought the concept of the gimmick for this show was actually not bad. On 11/14, Paul Heyman reveals that Hardcore Holly would be the sixth member of the Elimination Chamber match. However, Holly, before he came out to the ring to meet Heyman and Big Show to accept, the debuting Bobby Lashley attacked him, wiped out Holly, marched to the ring, confronted Heyman. He speared Big Show, grabbed the open contract from Heyman, and signed his name using the old Shawn Michaels loophole, 2004. Lashley would continue to wreak havoc over the next few weeks, assaulting Show amongst a handful of other ECW stars. Hardcore Holly made his ECW debut back on August 22nd, promptly aligned with Paul Heyman, who motivated Holly by telling him nobody wanted him in ECW. Holly made an impact immediately, interfering in various matches, bashing stars with a chair whenever he could. On 9/26, things get ugly for Holly when he is suplexed out of the ring through a table by Rob Van Dam. As Holly busted through the table, the plastic edging sliced open his back, leading to a bloody mess. The nasty bump gained him a little bit of street cred, and over the following weeks, Holly would tease a face turn before, on 11/7, turned on RVD and aligned with Heyman and his crew. Now, I think that was where the misstep with Holly was, because he actually gained some respect with that bump and kept wrestling through it. Like, that was pretty gory. And the match itself was really good. And I think if they had made him be, like, you know, a veteran face aligning with the ECW originals to stand up against Heyman, I think maybe that would have been a better direction for him.
Yeah, I wasn't a fan of him here at all to begin with, but if you needed some experienced, you know, muscle guys to be on the roster, that's fine. But I would have put Holly somewhere else, and I honestly would have put Sandman in this main event. I mean, he's the most decorated ECW champion of all time. I would have found a way to get him in this main event. But
what do you think, Timothy? Holly is a face better?
I think they should have. You always got to take advantage of, like, life's little happy accidents like that.
Right.
Having him get busted open and the crowd loves him, it's like, go with it. And at least for a while, don't just snap right back to heel, because there's no equity built in there to get, like, the crowd fucking cares that he turns back heel. They're just like, oh, great, he's still a prick, whatever. And then you lose all the value that you had. I mean, it's kind of similar to when the Brock Lesnar stuff happened with him, where he had some heat coming back from that, being like, you know, his neck was broken, blah, blah, blah. And then they just had Brock essentially squash him right afterwards, and he lost all the credibility that he might have had. Him being in the match overall, yeah, I mean, he's not over. He just shouldn't have been in the main event because no one cared about him. So, yeah.
All right, well, after a lengthy and successful run as ECW World Champion, Big Show's health issues finally got to him. Despite a large contract offered to re-sign with the company, Show knew he needed rest and rehab to get himself healthy again. And the only way to do that was to get off the road for a while. His contract expired in February. He'd reach out to other ventures before making his inevitable return, which we'll get to down the road. So I guess he only signed an 8-year deal when he signed. I thought he signed a 10-year for some reason, but
I thought he did too. I think we're getting confused with
Henry.
Mark Henry.
Yeah.
Mark Henry's was 10 years. Yeah.
All right. Well, he needed the fucking break. That's for sure.
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, even here when they keep showing the close ups of him in the chamber, you know, in the thing. I mean, his face is all dark and his eyes are, like, practically gone. I mean, he was a mess. It was not good. It was not good. It was good that he finally looked in the mirror and realized, holy shit, I should be dead. I need to get off the road. So. Made perfect sense.
On 10/24, Rob Van Dam defeated Big Show in a non-title ladder match to earn a title match at any time of his choice. The next week, Paul Heyman announced that RVD had chosen to have his match at the pay-per-view. However, Heyman decided to put the screws to RVD and announced that instead of a one-on-one match, RVD's title shot would also include four other competitors in an extreme elimination chamber. Later that night, Sabu defeated Kevin Thorne. 11/7, CM Punk and Test both qualified as Heyman announced that there was an open contract for the sixth spot and that the contract would be filled by the next week. At the end of the night, Hardcore Holly turned on RVD and Joey Styles speculated that Holly had joined Heyman. The following week, Lashley, blah, 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 we all know what happened there. Heyman tried to get Holly in the chamber again, giving him a match with RVD, but RVD prevailed to keep hold of his spot. So here we are. I thought this gimmick was worth a shot to bring a unique feel to the pay-per-view, showcase multiple stars. Like, I thought the intention was good. As we'll see, the execution leaves a lot to be desired. Show has stabilized the ECW title nicely during his time, but his body and time was up. Body completely shot. Crowd and internet fans is dying for Punk to win to kick off his run and become the torchbearer for ECW. Heyman and the guards come out to open the match, talks on and on about the legacy of ECW and Sabu's injury. He talks about the days of ECW's old guard have come to an end. The Big Show is the one to lead ECW into 2007, and that this will be his crowning moment. Show really looks completely awful at this point. Massive, bloated, eyes sunken in, swelled up, just not looking healthy at all. Punk gets one of the biggest pops of the night from a crowd that has been dead the whole time. test is massive and juiced up, like we talked about at Survivor Series. Shoehorned into this role, fine as an anti-ECW presence. Needed someone for the fans to boo, which is why I thought that we didn't need Holly in that role, too. Lashley gets a decent welcome, kind of clear his path is being set here with him moving from SmackDown. No one wanted Holly here, especially over Sabu. RVD is still RVD. Him and Holly opened things up with a slugfest and included Holly getting a near fall. Holly slings RVD to the grating, but RVD comes back and tries to leap off the second buckle, which Holly ducks, but RVD lands on the cage wall. RVD leaps off the cage, but Holly dodges and hangs himself across the top rope. Holly slams RVD on the grating a couple times and stomps away, but Holly eats a boot trying to come off the top in a dumb spot. RVD hits a rolling thunder off the top rope and onto the steel. Holly suplexes RVD into the ring for a two count, and then the two slug away until Punk enters with a chair to a big pop. Punk chucks a chair at Holly and hits a springboard clothesline on RVD. RVD hits Punk with a chair and then Monkey flips him on it. Punk recovers and leg drops RVD on the chair and springboard drop kicks Holly. And the crowd is really the most awake they've been all night here with Punk and RVD in the ring. Amazing when you have actually, you know, popular stars. RVD busts open as Punk slings him headfirst through the chair, but that was propped open between the buckles. Holly grabs Punk and swings him into the cage. Holly stomps away and punishes both guys and hits a hard superplex on Punk. Test enters fourth. He has a crowbar as his weapon. He uses it to bash Punk in the gut and then jams it in RVD's gash. I thought that was a pretty cool spot. Very gross. RVD comes back with a chair, smashing everyone, including a skateboard dropkick to Punk. RVD climbs the pod and hits a five-star frog splash on Punk to eliminate him and piss off the crowd. And, you know, they clearly had RVD pin him to try and temper the anger, but not happening. A tough break. Yep, go ahead.
You took that step. You took that step right out. That was exactly what I was going to say. You're exactly right on that. There's no doubt about
that. They clearly were trying to dim the hate. So tough break for Punk. It makes him look weak, but it kind of protects him in a way, too, to just get him out of there. And I don't know. I guess RVD hitting his finisher, it helps him a bit. Test drills Holly with a big boot for a botch near fall. The referee stopped counting, and then Holly ends up being eliminated, so it wasn't a near fall. The whole thing was fucked up. RVD hits Test with a kick, taunts Big Show amidst the confusion. RVD scales the pod, but Show trips him up from inside. Test bashes him with a chair and slams him. Test then goes up to the pod and hits the elbow off the top of the chair on RVD's face to eliminate him. And that was a nice spot, but the crowd is completely checked out now at this point. Punk and RVD eliminated by fucking Test, basically in the matter of a couple minutes. Not good. Test lies alone and rides until Lashley comes in. He gets a lukewarm reaction. Before he opens the door, Heyman's riot crew comes out and locks the pod. Lashley stews as Test taunts him with the crowbar. Lashley uses the table that's in his pod to bust open the chain roof, climbs out. I thought that was a nice spot, and then finally gets some kind of pop. Lashley hits a clothesline on Test off the top of the pod and starts to mow through him, slamming him hard into the plexiglass. Test recovers and chokeslams Lashley with the boot, but Lashley kicks the chair back in his face, playing to the relative silence here as he goes back on the attack. Lashley spears Test and eliminates him, and then stands there for a minute waiting for Big Show. Show enters with a barbed wire bat and stalks Lashley, who swings with the chair and survives the attack, and then bashes Show with the chair. Lashley sends Show crashing through the plexiglass, busting him open, and then punching away at the cut. Show chucks Lashley back in the ring, but Lashley blocks with a chokeslam with a DDT. Show gets one last gasp until Lashley cuts him down with a spear for the win and a mild pop. I actually thought the chamber match was okay. There were plenty of weapons. We got a lot of blood, some neat spots. It reminded me a lot of New Year's Evolution when we eliminated all the faces and just left the annoying, hated heels for Lashley to conquer to try and get him a pop. The pieces were there. The booking was smart, but the crowd just did not give a shit at all about Lashley. It was a strong finish, I thought, to Show's dominant reign. It was well-earned and paid off. You know, we talked a lot about how, like, JBL in 05 kind of had that shit ending to his reign. This one made sense. Like, Show has fought off every comer and finally succumbs in this setting. I think it signifies the original ECW rebirth is dead. Lashley is now the new dog. On top, all the ECW originals kind of, shuffled behind him. And again, the match in a vacuum is fine, but when you factor in all the politics and everything to go with it, it sucks. What did you think, Timothy?
Yeah, and as you were talking about it, saying, I kind of get where you're coming from. It's a nice gimmick to show off ECW. They've got all the weapons. It's the big elimination chamber. But it almost feels so not ECW that I kind of wish they hadn't done it.
Right.
And with the politics of trying to switch guys around, and they're so worried about, oh, we can't have – there's a lot of arguments about too many baby faces in there that are going to out-pop Lashley and be more over than him. I almost – as you're talking about a thought, and it was like they should have just done like a – Double Jeopardy match, which is like something that they did in ECW, and then so it can harken back to original ECW. You can have less guys in there, less guys to worry about them getting a better reaction than Lashley, and you could still do something very similar. On top of the fact that, like you said, the crowd is hot for some of these guys, but I've never seen Elimination Chamber live, but I assume it's really fucking hard in the crowd to see into the cage with all the chains and everything in the way. So it kind of affects even the crowd's ability to react when they can't really see too much of it. And yeah, getting rid of Punk early was stupid. Having Test beat both guys when he looks, I mean, the guy looks like he's a couple, you know, of one wrong move away from a heart attack at this point. It's just, he's red. He's huge. Yeah, and it does come, and it sucks to say that, but it's just the truth. Big Show looked amazing. Like you guys said, he looks like hell, like he needs to take time off, but it works so well as this big, nasty monster inside the cage, fogging up the glass, and I even love when
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, it almost looks like, too, like, him looking at Death's Door works in a way, because, like, he's just, he looks like a guy that wants to retire, but he's so dominant. He's like, somebody fucking beat me, you know what I mean? Like, he's just trudging along.
Yeah.
Just trudging along as, like, this dominant champion waiting for someone to show up that could handle him.
Right, and it even plays into his reaction to Lashley, where it's almost like he's goading him into putting him out of his misery. He's kind of doing death by cop, but it's with Lashley in his championship ring. Right. He's going out of his way, because as Lashley comes out, it's like, why is Big Show seething with anger at this guy, when it's kind of like, it should be the other way around? Well, Lashley shows no emotion when he should be the one really mad and amped up to beat Big Show. And I was going to say, I love Big Show swiping he's in the pod, and he's able to get his arm through, and he's swiping through like he's just going to get a piece of Lashley, and that's all he wants. It's so great. He just looks like a caged animal that's just ready to just pounce on Lashley. But all in all, I thought, you know, for an Elimination Chamber match, it's good. It's another one of these situations where an Elimination Chamber is not necessarily what I consider pro wrestling, because I'm more of a bare bones. I like it stripped down to minimal kind of grappling kind of wrestling stuff. So for me, it's all the pomp and circumstance that makes it a little bit too much. But they do a really good job at delivering what they're supposed to here. The Bob Holly fuck up is really awkward, especially because if you really wanted Lashley to dominate, you know, heels, why not have three heels for him to kind of run through? You cut out one and you just have it be the Test beat him for no reason. But all in all, I think they did an all right job. I think the crowd didn't give him anywhere near the reaction that they kind of deserved more throughout this match. But at this point, it's really tough to blame the crowd, though. Even if the show was shorter, it's still been a long show for what they've had to sit through this whole time.
That crowd is terrible. One of the worst crowds we've talked about. I mean, whether it was, you know, warranted or not, easily one of the worst crowds that we've dealt with, Scott.
Yeah. I got a couple of the steps that I typed, actually, you covered most of, so I'm going to come up with a new one here. I still think either Tommy or Sandman should have been in this match. I think the fans would have been a little bit more invested. I do like, though, that RVD came out last and not Lashley to maybe kind of throw the fans off a little bit. And I wrote down, but you covered it, that, like, RVD pinning Punk makes it seem any less shitty. It's just, I mean, we're not that. We were born, just not yesterday. It's stupid. But here's my thing. Because I'm sure a lot of people were probably wondering, wow, Lashley was getting these crazy pops on SmackDown. Why isn't he getting the pops in ECW? Well, that's simple. Because on SmackDown, he was the CM Punk. And Batista, Booker, those guys were the Big Shows and the Tests and the Hardcore Hollers.
I don't know if he was even the CM Punk. I just think he was.
No, I'm just using that symbolically in the sense that the fans liked him on SmackDown because they wanted him to beat these established guys. Now you're like, all right,
we wanted him to beat the established guys. I think he wasn't beating the guys they loved. That's more
right. And now it's like, well, we want Lashley to get over, but we want Punk over more. So have Lashley go do something else. You know what I'm saying? They probably thought, well, they're cheering Lashley. Let's put him here. And I'm like, you know, come on, guys. I mean, we're not that dumb. We understand the point here. You want to get Lashley over. You want him to be a champion. You just don't want to deal with Punk and this scrawny little guy with the messed up hair and the weird tattoos. And he doesn't fit on your other two shows. You've got bigger fish to fry. We have WrestleMania season. We need to build our two title matches, we have no room for this.
The thing is, in a vacuum, I feel like Lashley as the choice makes sense because they clearly saw something in him, right?
Right.
So,
no, I know.
Sending him to ECW to get some reps, be the top dog there, build up his name, be a champion, and then be able to transition over to Raw, SmackDown, and be a top level player, I thought actually made a lot of sense. The problem is the crowd wanted nothing to do with it. Like, you know, and I think they could have avoided it if they didn't even have Punk in the match. Like, why not have Punk fucking beat Daivari or something on the undercard? Give him a win there, or have him, you know, have him fight Knox for the freedom of Kelly Kelly.
Well, that's it. How about that? How about have right. Punk? What they should have done was had Knox and Kelly Kelly against Punk and
not even a
somebody.
Mixed tag. Just do Knox and Punk, Kelly's freedom on the line. Have Thorn fight Balls. You know, whatever. You could reshuffle things where you could get Tommy into a better slot or Sandman in a better slot. And let Punk pick up an undercard win. He frees Kelly. It's a natural storyline they've been building. And with him not being in the chamber, you're not getting fans' hopes up that he may win, especially because you knew he was a big Heyman guy. Heyman loved him in developmental. He brought him to ECW. Mm-hmm. He was pushing him mm-hmm. along. You're cock-teasing the fans by even putting him in the match. At least if he's not in the match, you're not getting the hopes up.
True.
It's really like the Roman Reigns-Danielson thing, and it's so funny that people acted like it was unprecedented, because when Lashley did debut on SmackDown, he got a huge pop, and the crowd was into him, and he speared Big Show, and he gets into the ring, and the crowd was going nuts, and they were into him, and then it was, once he's the one who's winning the match where their guy didn't win, which this time it was Punk, you know, for Roman it was Bryan Danielson, but they didn't want anything to do with him anymore. And it is so true. If they just not had Punk in this match, I think it would have made all the difference. And as you're talking, I was thinking, you know, Dreamer would have been perfect in here, because Dreamer could have taken some insane, crazy bump for Lashley to maybe even help get him over more. He could have done something just completely nutty with Dreamer, and the crowd would have bought into Lashley possibly. But right. with Punk in there, you're right. You do kind of tease that people think he's going to win, because the ECW crowd didn't hate Lashley from the start. They were into him. It really was just him beating Punk that they didn't like, or him, you know, being the champion instead of Punk that they didn't like.
And not being in an ECW stronghold, like, I don't think the crowd would have been mad if Lashley beat all the old ECW guys. You know what I mean? Like,
no, exactly.
They didn't care about them earlier at all. So it's like they didn't really care about Balls and Dreamer and Sandman a little bit, but like they clearly cared about Punk the most. Outside of like the Hardys, which to me felt like a completely different show. That match wasn't even really part of the show.
I know.
Like outside of that, like Punk was the most super, super over, even more, way more than RVD. So yeah, I don't think the Lashley result is nearly as bad if you keep Punk out of that match.
Yeah. And, I think Lashley now has a, you know, he has an open forum now, and he has a platform to grow a little bit, because obviously he's a guy that I think they want to see on Raw or SmackDown at some point in 2007. So this is a good spot for him. And I don't think the fans would care as much, again, if Punk wasn't one of the sacrificial lambs. There's no doubt about that. How they don't do something with Knox and Kelly Kelly. That's why I almost do think that they, like, I just want to flush this fucking show down the toilet. Just throw a bunch of matches on. Let's get the hell out of this shithole in Georgia. You know what I mean? It's like, I mean, it sounds crazy, but I do really think that they just put a bunch of nonsensical, illogical booking matches on just to get the show over with and get Heyman out of there. I mean, we laugh, JR, you say it, but – and I'm not saying anything conspiratorial, but it's almost like this card could have been a lot better and a lot easier to book if you actually just thought about it.
The pieces
and it really
there.
Feels like they didn't think about it.
No, the pieces are fully there.
There's no doubt the pieces are there.
Well, and the booking was all Punk and Kelly Kelly and Knox, and then, yeah, they just throw Thorn in there for no reason. It doesn't make any sense.
So it sounds like they wanted Punk. Oh, they'll be happy if Punk's at least in the match. No, they're not. If you're putting him in, they want him to win. If you don't want him to win, put him in something.
At least
he's going
to screw, though. Like, to build, like, the whole thing has been Heyman screwing guys, right? I mean, to get his...
Right.
So at least do something screwy to build some heat. He doesn't lose his clean. I mean, that he's out. He's
yeah,
the first
I mean,
one
have one of those Riot guys come in and hit him with a nightstick or some shit. I don't know. But it just just a big fucking mess. So Bobby Lashley is your new ECW.
Well, I had a question
champ.
For Timothy. So, Timothy, you watched all the TV. Just real quick, do you have a logical layout in your mind of what this car could have looked like based on the build?
Well, that's the problem, is the build was nothing but this match. And the last week, or like maybe 2 weeks before, they mentioned that they were going to have the Hardy Boys there. And then it turned into the Hardy Boys and Eminem on the last week before the show. But the last episode of the show was all these guys, the six guys in the Elimination Chamber, having singles matches, and they had no other stories that they had been building up except for Punk and Kelly Kelly. So it just, it felt like, yeah, the layout should have been Punk versus Knox, and it didn't even have to be as, you know, kind of barbaric as saying that her freedom is on the line, but just right. saying that they're having a match, and then somewhere in it, she turns completely and goes with Punk. Right. You put, yeah, like I said, you put someone like Dreamer in here just to put Bobby Lashley over. He's in the Elimination Chamber. You have Dreamer take a wild, crazy bump for Lashley. He basically kills himself. You could do FBI versus probably – I would have put FBI with Elijah Burke and Sylvester Takai like they did and maybe possibly just kind of anything else to really get Elijah Burke and the him over more as heels, maybe have them – do some like dastard or even just stay dominant the way they are. But I mean, there's also, there was so little else for them to work with at the, I mean, storyline wise that it was going to feel thrown, it was going to feel thrown together completely, putting the card together unless they did, you know, unless you're asking me to rebook the TV for the month before, cause they didn't build anything else. There wasn't any other real storylines going on that you could even draw from to make the show work. So I don't know. I think, maybe you cut, like I said, if you cut the Elimination Chamber out altogether and make it a match with less competitors,
right.
I think then you could use some of these guys who obviously have issues that are in the chamber with each other. They could have had matches, singles matches or something. But yeah, it did kind of feel like the whole thing was, it was poorly booked and poorly, sloppily thrown together. And who knows what it was, because the TV wasn't great either, but from, you know, the backstage reports, they were, Heyman was butting heads with Vince the whole time on the TV too. So it's really tough to say whose right. fault it was in here, but in the end, we all know who gets fired and who's gone afterwards. So it's kind of like, it didn't matter whose fault it was. It got solved. And then watching it and thinking about it, how much of this stuff is still the same with just a guy who's maybe less likely to get fired is the one who's butting heads with Vince now, you know? So who knows what's going to happen from here.
The thing, too, that was backwards, they had all of these old ECW veterans, and they're all the faces. And then, so naturally, you're trying to build, like, Heyman is going with the new guys in his mind, all the anti-ECW guys. But then you have these two guys come in that are not ECW guys as faces. And Punk, you can say, okay, well, he's a Heyman guy, and he's kind of in the mold, and the crowd loves him, blah, blah, blah. And then you bring in Lashley, who naturally maybe should have been a heel because he's against everything. You know, it almost makes you wonder, like, should they have had Heyman pull the old, you know, okey-doke on show like they did back with him and Lesnar at Survivor Series 02, and Lashley's this new big heel monster, the new non-ECW conventional guy, and let him feud with Punk on top. You know, like something like that could have maybe worked. But they've established that all the ECW veterans are your faces, but then they bring in a non-ECW guy to come in and be the top face. That makes sense? Like, there's no original ECW heels, really.
No.
Right, and that was the plan was for Lashley to turn heel the next day on TV.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah, oh, that's what I was saying. The plan was it was going to be Heyman and Lashley as a team with Lashley as the heel. And because Big Show is gone. And because Heyman's gone, they didn't go with it. But you might be right that it would have been better to do it here on this show.
Right, yeah. That's
because it's the big show where important things are happening. Why not kind of seal the deal on this show? But it also, that would have been even a bigger headache, because if you think about it, then the next day, Heyman's not in the company anymore. What do you do with Lashley?
Well, you say Lashley as the said, fuck you. I only used Heyman to get into ECW, and now I'm your champion. What are you going to do? Heyman's gone. No one can save you now.
Right, and then you have Punk as the, hopefully the savior after all is said and done, and they actually get the title on someone that the crowd likes for the first time in years. But yeah, Heyman's idea was essentially just to have Lashley replace Big Show as he was on the way out, but he didn't want to end the dominant heel champion storyline yet. So, but I do like your idea that it should have been shown here just to make it that much, maybe have that much more impact.
Right.
Right. Yeah. All right.
It was a clusterfuck. The whole thing is just a mess, and it is sad that this is. I mean, it's sad and it's good. It's the death of ECW revival proper, but it is the start of ECW, the kind of developmental brand that then turns into NXT and you know what we have now that's really awesome. So, in some ways it's good, in some ways it's bad, but
It needed to happen.
It's wrestling.
I mean, you could see they were never going to do what people wanted. So it really just needed to die. And the worst thing they did was keep the ECW name. Like, they should have almost immediately just, like, changed the name of the show or something. Like,
right.
I swear, like, for 3 years, people didn't give it a chance because it was, like, the failed ECW. When even though, as we'll see, Scott, it gets pretty good.
It does get good,
I think a lot of people didn't want to give it a chance because it had the ECW tag on it. Like, I feel like that hurt them more than anything else for a while.
Yeah.
Not at this point. At this point, they were warranted. But later on.
Later on, when they should have given it a chance to be resurrected, but the problem was it still had the tag on it, and as far as you were concerned, or as far as the fans are concerned, this isn't 1995, 1996, 1997. So, all right, let us go to the report card. This might be pretty easy.
Yeah. Nothing in the
usually,
top 10.
Nothing in the top. So is it worse than Vengeance?
No, I think I actually liked it better than Vengeance. I'm not going to lie.
All right, is it worse than Cyber Sunday?
Yeah, probably.
Okay, so we'll put it at 10.
What do you think, Timothy? I don't know if you've been tracking these at all with us.
God, I mean, I'm trying to think. What's the main event on that Cyber Sunday?
The Champion of Champions triple threat, Cena versus Booker versus Big Show.
Oh,
yeah, it might
think,
be better than that, actually. Maybe it was close.
Yeah, I remember that show not being too terrible, but this show... Watching it, the show is horrible, or thinking about it, the show is horrible, but there's some stuff that's decent.
It's a quick watch, too. It moves along. There's no...
Yeah.
Like, all the matches are short, so it's not a great pay-per-view, but it's not like... I don't think it's the dog shit that its reputation leads you to think.
No, it's like that opening tag is worse than I remember, but everything else is better than I remember.
It's not worse than King of the Ring 95.
No, that's for sure.
Because that main event...
No,
is the utter shit.
It's a disappointing show more than anything. I don't think it's outright, like, terrible. I mean, it's not... I didn't feel like, oh, my God, fucking end. Like, I felt that with a lot of Vengeance. And Vengeance has the awful Kane, fake Kane. The main event is brutal. Like, to me, Vengeance, there's higher expectations than there were with this fucking mess.
And the length makes a big difference. Even though, you might be gypped when you're watching it live and you paid for it, a long bad show is always going to beat a short bad show, no matter how bad the short show is, you know?
Right.
So yeah, right. I think that I'd have to put it better than the Cyber Sunday.
So what do you think, JR? Should we move it?
Yeah, I mean, it's right around there. Yeah, might not.
All right. All right, I'll do that. So, okay. All right. There can't be, I mean, I know the matches weren't great, but they can't be any worse than the four we have under worst match.
No, I don't think so.
No. Would you put the Chamber with the best match?
No.
No? Okay. So here's our report card to date. 11 pay-per-views in from 11 to 1, Vengeance, Cyber Sunday, December to Dismember, Survivor Series, Backlash, Great American Bash, No Mercy, SummerSlam, Judgment Day, Unforgiven, and One Night Stand. We have four right now for worst match. The Braun Panties match from Great American Bash, Lita versus Mickie James from Cyber Sunday, Kane versus Kane from Vengeance, and Kane versus Big Show from Backlash. And we have 10 nominees right now for the best match of the report card year. London and Kendrick versus the Pitbulls from Great American Bash, DX versus the McMahons and Big Show, Hell in a Cell from Unforgiven, Triple H versus Edge versus Cena from Backlash, Regal versus Benoit from No Mercy, Edge versus Cena from SummerSlam, Foley versus Flair from SummerSlam, Benoit versus Finlay from Judgment Day, Edge Foley Lita versus Dreamer Funk Beulah from One Night Stand, Cena versus RVD from One Night Stand, and right now at the top of our list for the best match of the creative year, Edge versus Cena TLC from Unforgiven. So there you go.
Yeah, I wouldn't put
more
for anyone near there.
No. One show left in the calendar year, JR, but we have, let's see, 5 shows left in the report card. So there you go.
Yeah, March for sure. All right, so we're off next week, Scott. Got some work stuff going on. So we'll be back in 2 weeks' time to wrap up 06 with Armageddon.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm getting tired of 2006, so I'm kind of glad it's here. we'll be back then. So this week you got main event?
I do. The Doctor will be returning. I'm going to see if D'Amato's around. And one of your compadres from Clotheslines and Headlines, Mr. Nate Milton, will be joining me because he lives near where Backlash will be, and so I figured it'd be fun to have his take on it. We'll preview Backlash, and kind of want to talk about this Gems collection that's going to hit the network tomorrow. It's getting a lot of hullabaloo
some great matches on this Hidden Gems countdown, of course, including the much anticipated 1980, I think it was 1984 Battle of Atlanta, final Battle of Atlanta, or last Battle of Atlanta. So, be a jam packed main event.
It was older than that, isn't it? It's like 82 or 83.
I thought it was 80. I thought it was 84. Let me double check. Go ahead, talk to Tim. Hey Tim, how you doing?
Hey, how's it going?
All right, Tim, do you want to plug anything while Scott looks it up?
Yeah, so Lucha Undead's always been coming out. We don't miss weeks ever. We've got Dave Musgrave interview coming out probably right around the same time as this episode. That's a lot of fun getting to know him more personally. Otherwise, This Week in Wrestling will be back. We missed 2 weeks. Not going to give away anybody else's business, so I don't even know why, but you'll hear why, but it will be back. After you're hearing this, it'll be the Sunday after this. There will be This Week in Wrestling. We're going to talk about the AWE show that just recently showed up on the High Spots On Demand. And I've got another podcast, my official first kind of podcast or thing that's going to be somewhat frequently over at Wrestling With Words coming out. Should be very shortly, so just keep a lookout for that. And follow me at Lucha Undead. That's on Twitter. That's the main way to get a hold. And that's it for me.
Nice, Scott. Time's up.
Okay. It is 1983. Featured Sawyer and Rich in a fully enclosed Last Man Standing cage match. So.
All right. And we'll have a new clotheslines and headlines next week as well. So keep an eye out for that. As well as letters from Kayfabe, as Parv talked about earlier as well. So lots going on. Mm-hmm. PlaceNation.com. Thank you all for listening. For Scott, for Timothy, and Parv. I'm Justin. We're out. We'll talk to you in a couple weeks' time. Goodbye. They should just fire everyone. Not just Pauline.
Yeah, they should have just fired the whole every worker, cameraman, that referee that looks weird. He looks kind of like Jerry Lawler's son or something.
They should have just kept Ariel and what's her name, the one whose boobs were sticking out, hanging out. They should have just kept them.
DiPietro or whatever.
DiPietro, yeah, and Ariel and anybody with boobs.
I'm gonna take a ride and try and find her in.
Bitches let them rain, giving them a wet welcome to the house of pain. Stay dusted, maybe I should, cause these rappers will have your phone tapped like Savion Glove. And on the West, yo, police corrupt some of bloods, but these Teflons are loaded, exploding some mugs. I'm like furious and boys in the hood, but at the drive-thru, I ain't running, I'm dumping. Crazy like a pyro and loped up, know how Nas do. I'm calling henchmen and conception to organize a black truce. Then we party hard, party with Nas, since there ain't no more Mardi Gras. And Bush won't apologize, I got gangster hoes, Kobe Bryant scared to sodomize. And 45s for them suckers y'all idolize. Y'all yelling my name, but y'all soon dying. Trying to portray real, but they be lying, cause they want the real niggas to die so they can gain. But never that, this ain't everlasting, this the house of pain.